welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here, as always, to talk about stuff. This week on the show, we're going to have a kind of grab bag of mini topics.
Yeah.
As little games and things like that we've played.
Yeah, we've been shoring up our top 10 games list of the year. And, oh boy.
Oh boy. We'll talk about that at the end. I think that'll be our our next episode after this.
Yeah.
Whenever that's recorded. But our main topic today is going to be Rogue One, a Star Wars story. We'll talk about that with spoilers at the end. Let's do the quick reactions.
Yeah.
I want to say mine first because I had a bunch of kind of scattered thoughts on Twitter. Because I think it's hard for me to have a unified opinion on this movie.
Yeah.
I like it. I think it's a good movie. On the like spectrum of movies, I think this is on the side of good movies.
Okay.
But I do have problems with it. And I think it's, you know, if I had to summarize my overall thoughts, I think Rogue One has a very messy script that needed another pass or two. And we'll talk about that. But I think, like, this is a movie without a first act. And I've never seen that as a problem before.
Uh-huh.
Where they, like, there's literally not a first act to this movie, and it's a problem. But I think the acting is great throughout. Like Force Awakens last year, they got really good actors, and I think they're all doing great work. I don't think the script supports them in the way Force Awakens supported, you know, Daisy Ridley and John Boyega and those new people. So that's an issue, but I think the acting was still really good. You got Donnie Yen kicking some fucking ass in this movie.
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, a little bit. You get like one scene of him kicking ass.
You get a couple, and you get more than I frankly thought they would have devoted to him.
Yeah, but I felt like you see the scene where he kicks ass. You at least know it's there from the trailer. I was hoping there'd be one more, but
we'll talk about it. And I think as a piece of filmmaking, it's fantastic. I think Gareth Edwards can direct a fucking movie, and
sure.
I think there are some images in here that are unbelievable, and I think the way Gareth Edwards plays with iconography is fascinating, and I think he does much more thematically to tie this thing together than the writing or the storytelling does. And I do think there's some phenomenal visual storytelling going on here, and I think of all the Star Wars movies, on a cinematography level, this one blows me away the most. So that's one thing I would say this is a superlative for this movie. And it has great scenes. It has some of my favorite scenes in any Star Wars movie in it. As a whole, I think it has issues, and it's one of those cases where I have seen very extreme reactions on both sides. I've seen people who love it, and I've seen people who hate it, and I can absolutely understand both of those viewpoints. It's a weird thing.
Yeah.
And I'm not quite on either side. I guess I'm more on the side of I like it. I think it's a good movie. But those are my overall thoughts. I didn't like it as much as Force Awakens. If we're playing that game. But yeah, so that's kind of my overall thoughts on Rogue One, which are scattered. And I have rarely been as excited to kind of just dive into different parts of the movie with you, because I think it's a fascinating movie to talk about.
So to go into my reactions, and I just saw the movie last night, so like I'm still fairly fresh on it, and I feel like my thoughts on the movie are still kind of forming. Like my more like sort of complicated thoughts on the movie are still kind of forming. But the more I think about it, the more negative I'm going on the movie.
That's interesting, because the more I've thought about it, the more I've liked the parts I liked.
Yeah, because I felt like in the moment, there are scenes and moments and sequences that I enjoyed quite a bit, because it is, I think you're right, with Gareth Edwards' directorial style is so distinct and powerful, and he's so great at sort of capturing these big sort of like monolithic events, and like, you know, with Godzilla in his Godzilla movie and Death Star in this, and like the just everything he does with the Imperials on the visual side, I think is amazing. But the severe issues this movie has with its story and characters make it so that the more I think about the movie, the more it's just like, you know, like this movie is full of nothing characters, and the plot is sort of feels really contrived, and there's a lot of really kind of cloying references to me to Star Wars Episode 4, which obviously is the thing that happens next in the continuity, but it got really excessive at some point of them making references to that shit happening all the way up to literally the very end of the movie, and that got like way more than any of the shit in like the Star Wars prequel trilogy. That prequelizing really kind of annoyed me, because I felt it was extremely distracting at some point.
I agree, and what's weird is that it's one of a number of things in this movie that we'll get into when we talk about spoilers, where if they had done a little of it, certain moments would work great for me.
Yeah.
But they do a lot of it.
Like, and they do more of it as the movie goes on, where at the end, it is so dense with references. It's ridiculous.
But the thing is, like, some of the things they do at the end, I would be totally okay with if they weren't doing that throughout the movie.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, yeah. And so we have a lot to talk about. They do some other things that, boy, I cannot wait to converse with you about. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about. So,
shit, yeah.
Oh, you know, I would recommend you see it. If you like Star Wars, I think it's a movie worth seeing.
People have already seen it. Yes. You know, Disney is, that's almost like one of the, a whole other discussion with this is like Disney's strategy of putting out a Star Wars movie right next to Christmas every single year for probably the rest of our lives is them just printing fucking money, and I wish I would be okay with them printing money if they were making movies that, for me, like, I'm 0-2 on these new Star Wars movies because I didn't like The Force Awakens and I don't like this. I would probably say I like this. I'd say I probably like them about the same. Like, I don't like these movies that much.
Okay. Well, yeah, and I like The Force Awakens more. You know, I'm interested to see where they go in the future. I would love... if they keep making lots of Star Wars movies, I would love them to get Gareth Edwards to do one with a script that I think is more worthy of his talents.
Yeah, I just want to see, because I feel like it's a weird thing where a lot of the problems that this movie has, I feel like, are also problems that his Godzilla movie had in terms of telling a story. And I just want to be assured that that's not him.
He's not a writer, and that's a weird thing, because he's done, these are two movies that are, he didn't write the scripts for,
yeah.
Hollywood productions that he signs on for, so I am curious if you had a scenario where he had a better script to work with.
Yeah, like it's something where it's hard to tell if it's just a coincidence that some of like the character stuff, the character issues that this movie has reminds me a lot of the character issues that Rogue One had, or that Godzilla had when it switched off of Bryan Cranston.
There are some directors who are better with movies that are not character focused. And I know that's a weird thing to say about mainstream movies because we're so used to like character focused things. I don't know if that's his mode. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, it just feels like he needs to make a movie that, like, accommodates that. And I don't think this movie needs stronger characters because it relies a lot on you caring for the characters at the end.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about it. So let's go ahead and move on to different bits of stuff. Here's another thing that we're going to talk about in spoilers a little later on. This will not be our main topic, but we're going to talk about it a little bit. I finally played Call of Duty Infinite Warfare.
Yes.
It was on sale on Amazon last week, and I'm like, fuck yeah, bought it. Oh, I already told that story, because it was just such a weird install process for that fucking game. Anyway, but once you actually sit down and play the game, I mean, you talked about this when you reviewed it, that Infinite Warfare is three very, very, very different games that you get on one disc.
Yeah. Four, if you count Modern Warfare Remastered, if you got that version.
Right. So, we'll just stick with Infinite Warfare. Yeah. But you get zombies, and I did play some zombies.
Okay, I haven't touched that mode at all.
It's horrible. Okay. It is one of the worst things I've ever played in a video game, and it is so tonally dissonant.
Like, what kind of experience do you have with the past zombie modes?
I love them. I've played the first two or three Treyarch ones. So the original World at War had that.
Yeah, that was the first one.
That's still my favorite. I just think it's a good little mini mode. And then I think I played the one in Black Ops 1, which is the one where you're the different presidents in the bunker.
Right, yeah.
And I thought that was fun, but also getting, I think, a little spreading itself too thin. And then I have not played beyond that. So this is the first one, but like, it's out of it. Like, it's so weird to me. Mechanically, it is as different as you can get from Infinite Warfare. Yeah. Other than the controls are generally similar. You know, like, the stick does melee. Other than that, the guns are different, the character types, the graphics look different, it's not even in space.
Yeah, it's like a weird 80s thing, right?
Yeah, and like, it opens with like a, I'm not kidding, a 5 to 10 minute cartoon cutscene, like a Saturday morning cartoon cutscene, and I started this like 2 hours after finishing the Infinite Warfare campaign, which one of the darkest, heaviest things you will ever play in a video game, and then it cuts to that, like, clearly, whoever made the zombies mode and whoever made campaign had no communication.
Yeah.
There's nothing to... And, like, when you go back to the original zombies mode in World at War, it was aesthetically similar. That was the kind of... the thing that made it work.
Yeah, it was Nazi zombies, and it was something you unlocked after you beat the campaign.
Yeah.
And it was just like, okay, yeah, like, you're in this, like, destroyed Nazi castle fighting Nazi zombies. It worked.
And that's why the joke worked. Because they weren't shoving it in your face. This shoves it in your face. So it's like, it's a really bad Left 4 Dead knockoff. And again, I don't really even care, but it's just like, that's bad. The multiplayer...
It's Call of Duty multiplayer.
It's fine. It's not anything good. I think some of the maps are very good and interesting, and some of the maps are not. At least it has some of the same guns from campaign, but overall it does not.
But, like, the guns are... Even if it's the same gun from campaign, they feel very different because the campaign actually does really interesting things with its weapons.
That was what I was going to say, is because, like, the campaign of all the Call of Duties dives really deep with its mechanics, and you come out of it having a really good sense of that game's mechanics, and then the multiplayer does nothing with that, and that's very disconcerting, because, you know, if you pick up Doom or something, and you get really good at Doom, and then you go into multiplayer, it's fun because it's an extension of what you did in single player.
Sure, yeah.
This is not that, and that's very bizarre. Like, it's very clear to me that, and I think this is true because it's the most, you know, ambitious campaign they've ever done, that all the work went into the campaign, and some other team...
I mean, it is different, like, different groups of people are making those different modes of that game. Like, that is true.
And that's a problem, I think. But to me, if you judge it as the campaign, and I am totally okay doing that, because we do that all the fucking time, and I don't think it's fair to hold Call of Duty to a different standard than
other. Like, that's how, like, when we, even if you enjoy the multiplayer in Doom and Uncharted 4, like, when we talk about those games and how much we like those games, we're almost always just talking about the campaign.
And I do get it's weird for Call of Duty, because it's very rare that you play a Call of Duty game and the primary draw is the campaign. It has been a very long time since that was the case.
Yeah.
At least for the general public and the hype train. And that is the case here with Infinite Warfare. The campaign is long, it is meaty, and it is, you said this at the time, and I agree with you 100%, it is the best story ever told in a first-person shooter.
Yeah.
And I include games I love like the Halo series in that. It is the best narrative that you will find in a first-person shooter and told through a first-person shooter framework. It is spectacular. The writing and the subtle characterization they constantly do throughout that game, and... just the way it puts you in the shoes of these characters and the way it builds to an ending that is such a gut punch, I couldn't even believe I was playing a game with the words Call of Duty on it.
Yeah, now you get why when I beat that game and I finished the credits, I tweeted out, it is stupid how good the storytelling in this video game is.
It would be like if Michael Bay turned around after Transformers 5 and made a movie on par with Saving Private Ryan.
Exactly.
And you would go, where the fuck was that inside that guy?
Yeah, like, that's Transformers 6 is, like, the Saving Private Ryan of Transformers movies.
And you would be like, where did that come from?
Uh-huh.
And I really do feel, when I played Infinite Warfare, and I think if you've played it, you'll know, and we'll talk about this later, I think it is a pretty direct thematic refutation of what Call of Duty has been doing since Modern Warfare 1.
Uh-huh.
I think you can read it that way, and it's very interesting. Just like the way, you know, all the Call of Duty games have abused that idea of player death since
Modern Warfare. After Call of Duty 4, like, popularized it with the nuclear explosion part.
And I think the way they investigate those ideas in Infinite Warfare is fascinating, it is beautiful, and there is some writing in this game that is among the most beautiful and poignant things I've ever played in a video game. And I will say, I had a draft of my top 10 list before I played this game, and it threw the whole thing into chaos.
Yep.
Whole thing into chaos because, man, this is one of the best games made in its genre ever. And I think you might enjoy it even more if you're on my level where I have not played a Call of Duty game since Modern Warfare 3.
Right.
So for me, it's like I don't have some of those year-to-year preconceived notions, and it just blew me away. And we're talking about the story a lot because it's easy to get on that. I want to stress that if you stripped the story out, I still think it would be one of the best games of the year. In terms of level design and mechanics and the way that game progresses.
And, like, spectacle. Like,
yes.
If you want to see, like, production values in work on a modern video game, like, Infinite Warfare is the game you should show someone.
It's unbelievable. The other thing I think it does better than any FPS I've ever played is equipment.
It has the
best equipment, and you want to use it. It's not like in Halo 3 where you get your bubble shield and you're like, I might use this someday.
Yeah, like the process of before each mission going and, like, picking your loadout is so much fun because you want to, like, use the different guns and, like, then use them in different situations and use, like, your shield and all that stuff and load your character out. Yeah.
And I said this on Twitter, but I think it's a legitimate question. Sean, can you think of another recent game as widely underrated as Infinite Warfare?
No, like, and it's something where I feel so vindicated by you having, the same reaction to this game as I did, because it is something where, like, I played that game, I was like, I went to the reviews, because I had glanced at the reviews before I got it, just out of curiosity, but I had the game pre-ordered anyways, because I knew I wanted to play it for, like, intellectual purposes, if nothing else, even if I didn't like the game. And then, like, so I was like, I played the game, I finished it, I loved it to death, I thought, like, you cannot play through that game and, like, get to the end and then get through what they do with the credits and not have a strong reaction to it. And then I went and read the reviews, and the reviews are like, yeah, it's a pretty good Call of Duty campaign that has more memorable characters than usual. I'm like, that's your takeaway? Like, that's all you get? Like, were we playing the same fucking game? Like, there's no mention about how, like, to me, this game has a, like, economy of storytelling that you just do not find in video games anywhere. It's something that feels, like, generally reserved for movies that can do it very well, and games have an issue of, like length and like clunky exposition that games just tend to have like really awkward bulky stories, or they have no story at all. And if you're like a big RPG, a big bulky story is fine. If you are a tight like 8 hour first person shooter campaign, you can't have bulky, clunky exposition because it dominates the whole game, because like most of that running time is you actually playing the video game. And Call of Duty Infinite Warfare like solves that problem by telling this tight, thematically cogent story in a tight like 7 to 8 hour first person shooter campaign. I've never seen that before.
I quipped about this, but I think it's true. It is a better Halo game than the last few Halo games.
Yeah, this is like if you have been wanting to play a prequel to Halo that takes place with like the Civil War stuff between like the UNSC and the like border colonies or whatever they call them, which is like the backstory for Halo. Like this is just that. Like this is exactly that setting.
But it's like it's something Halo ran into, where Halo 1 had this grand revelation of how to tell stories in that setting, which was to have Cortana in your ear and things like that. And it's great. But as the Halo games got more complex in their narratives, I think Halo 3 and Reach survived it just fine, but 4 has some narrative deficiencies, and then 5 falls off a fucking cliff and face plants.
Yeah.
And it is interesting how I feel like Infinite Warfare picked up that torch and said, we know how to do a space shooter, and we're just going to throw down.
Yeah.
And we're going to do this. And, you know, my only worry is that because this game has had some mixed reaction and a lot of fans bitching about it without, I assume, playing it, and it's had lower sales, I hope that doesn't impact what Infinity Ward gets to do with this going forward.
Yeah, because I so desperately want a sequel to this game, like in that universe that tells another sort of story in that war, you know? Like, I want to see them tell a story from, like, the Martian side or something like that, because I think there's so much potential to be mined from, like, that team doing more.
Yeah, it is a hell of a game, and I will admit, and I think it's inevitable if you see these two directly next to each other, playing Infinite Warfare, and then I saw Rogue One the following night after I finished it, it definitely colored how I saw Rogue One. I think Rogue One and Infinite Warfare are actually very interesting counterpoints in how they try to ultimately tell the same kind of story.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very curious to hear if anyone else has kind of seen the two of them and thought of that. And I want to talk about those together a little bit at the end.
Sure.
Because I think it's an interesting study in kind of counterpoints there. But yeah, so I played that. You've played some games, Sean.
Yes, I have played two video games that I've been wanting to play for a long time. One I've been wanting to play for a very, very long time. Yep. So I guess I'll talk about that first, because that is the first one I played, was The Last Guardian, which is, if you have been living under a rock for like fucking 8 years or however long this game has been in development, it's the latest, or I guess probably the last game, because they've been disbanded, game from Team Ico, which made Ico and Shadow of the Colossus on the PS2, which are sort of like these cult classic beloved games that pushed sort of like how you tell story in games in different ways forward, and like what, like it felt like a lot of ways those games are the precursor to the indie boom that we got with like stuff like Braid and Limbo and stuff like that, kind of are in that tradition but a lot smaller. And so yeah, this is Fumito Ueda, who's the sort of the creative lead of those games, has been making The Last Guardian for 8 years or something. It's been E3 constantly. Finally, it is out on the PS4 after like the PS3. And if you play this game on the PS4, it totally makes sense. There are like things about the game, like fundamentally, that aren't like graphic things, but just the way the game plays, and like Trico, the creature that you're with, that like that would not work on the PS3. Like it's too demanding in terms of animation and stuff like that. The PS3 could not have handled it, because even the PS4 in certain places chugs. But yeah, so I finally got to play The Last Guardian, and I have to say, I've if you go online and you read the discussion about this game, it is incredibly divisive, because there are either people who fucking hate this game, or there are people who fucking love this game, and I fucking love it. Like, and I totally get people who have their issues with some things that the game has, with like controls and stuff like that can be a bit clunky. But ultimately, this is a game where it is about, I mean, what it looks like it's going to be about, like, if you go see that E3 trailer from its launch from, like, 2007 or whatever, of this boy, like, trapped in this, like, weird tower and just sort of dropped there and then thrown in with this weird giant creature that is this sort of, like, mix of a bird and a cat and a dog and just this big kind of, like, weird dragon creature. And he has to work with this creature called Trico to try to get out and survive and figure out what's going on, and they both need to rely on each other to survive in this place. And it is about that bond between these two characters, this boy and this animal, and that is what the game is. And it is something where the technology behind this game in terms of animation, where like both for the boy and then especially for Trico, the quality of the animation is something I have like never seen in a game before, that they have such a believable presence. And it's not something that is like 100% realistic. It is slightly exaggerated in a lot of ways, which is, I think, helps create this sense of like a real like emotional connection with these characters, that when the boy hurts or when Trico hurts, you feel it because the animation is so good and the sound design is so good that like when you pull a spear out of Trico's side to sort of like heal him, like you feel that. And this is a game where like I felt like every hour, like, I was just wincing because something happened. I was like, oh, God, like, that boy just, like, sprained his ankle. And it's like, I feel like I sprained my ankle because of the sort of empathetic connection you share with these characters. But then also the AI design behind Trico, who is with you basically for the whole game. If he's not, like, literally with you right that second, you know he's out there somewhere in the world. The AI with him, while I can understand some people being frustrated that he doesn't, he's not like 100% responsive. You do not have direct control over him or anything like that. But the way he moves around the world and he sort of acts on his own, and the way he kind of like, when you try to give him a command of like gesturing like, hey, like, let's go over there, he sort of looks where you're pointing and he kind of looks around and then he looks back and then he kind of backs up and then he's like, and then you kind of see, oh, he gets it. Like, it creates this sort of connection with the character where you see him learning. You see him like changing over the course of the game. You see, just based on his body language, you understand how he is reacting to things. And so the game has some issues. I think the game is a little bit too long. Some of the puzzles are a bit obtuse in certain areas, because the game at its core, like what you are doing is it's like a puzzle platformer with you having this Trico character with you. But it so 100% nails the thing it needed to nail. And I can tell that because when I have talked to other people about playing this game, I am constantly saying shit like, oh yeah, and then we got up through that hole. And then I realized like that was me, because Trico's just an AI character. But while you're playing the game, it feels like you are playing a co-op with your dog. And that's like, that is what you need. You know, that's what this game needs to be.
I will admit, I have not played this yet.
Yeah.
I had it on pre-order, and I canceled just because I was still in the middle of Final Fantasy XV.
Sure.
And cleaning up some other things, and I thought, I'll push it off a little bit. And I also I knew you were going to play it, and I wanted to hear your thoughts, because you're right, the reaction is so all over the place, yeah. There's no way to know what to make of it. But I have a dog. I have a very, like, close relationship with my dog, and I've been almost, like, intimidated by this thing of, like, is this game going to break me or something? But now I feel like I need to play it.
Yeah, I think you should play it for sure. Because it's also something where before I saw Rogue One, there was like a really brief ad for The Last Guardian, which is actually not a great ad for that game. But like it was like the boy, it's a very familiar situation if you played the game, but it's the boy running away from all these sort of soldiers that are the enemies that are trying to capture you. And he runs to like the end of this bridge. And then Trico just sort of like drops down and lands on the other side of this broken bridge. And when I saw him, because that had been like a week after I finished the game, and I saw him and like, I was like, oh, because it's like, I see that as that character. And like, I have that personal connection to that character in a way that is not just like, I like that character, or it's like, oh, you know, in the way that if I see like Nanako or something from Persona 4. Like, I love that character so much and I have a connection to that character. But as a character, like Trico, the way that that game forces you to work with that character, it makes him feel real to you in a way that's really hard for me to try to explain. That it did feel like when I saw him in that ad, it was like, I imagine it would be like if you saw a picture of your dog and you're like, oh yeah. Hey, and it's like, yeah, like you just recognize that immediately. And it is a really bizarre sensation, and I've never seen a game even get anything close to that. You know, like there are plenty of games like The Last of Us that have Ellie that is with you the whole time, that's like, I never felt like I was playing The Last of Us with Ellie. I was playing The Last of Us, the video game, and Ellie is a character in that game that is with you. Where it's like, with The Last Guardian, it's like, no, Trico and I solved this game together. Like, we went on this journey together, and we had fun, and, you know, and we laughed together, and we cried together, and we loved, and we hurt, and all that stuff. And it is a really, really powerful, effective game to me in a lot of ways. It is something where I think for some people it's just not going to work for different reasons, but I love the game to death.
Yeah, I'm going to have to play this.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Because luckily we're not doing our top 10 this week. So
I still have time. Yeah, exactly. So you can have time to do that. Then After Last...
Can I say one story really quick?
Okay, sure, go ahead.
You mentioned Nanako from Persona.
Yes.
So, my brother and I were just goofing off last night and playing some different... He's home for Christmas, because he's usually up off of college. And we were playing some different just games on different systems, just kind of... Sometimes you do that.
Sure, right? Yeah.
And one of the things I said was, I was like, I'm going to sit you down, I'm going to play the beginning of Persona 3 with you. Because I've slowly been whittling him down to the point where, like, you're going to play Persona. And I can tell he's also, like, getting... The hype for Persona 5 is getting out to people, I think, who don't normally play those games. So he's also like, I kind of want to play Persona 5. I'm like, you should play the other ones. Not because you need to know the story, just because they're good.
Yeah.
And also I think, and tell me if I'm wrong, it might be tough to go back to 3 and 4 after you've played 5, given the technological leap.
Yeah, I would probably say so. Like, it is definitely something where, and it is like, there are things, like, since Persona 5 does through, like, I think very clever gameplay things, it makes reference to its heritage. I think it is like, there's an element of it being enriched by you knowing what Persona 3 and 4 are.
Yeah. So anyway, we had the PS3 on. We had been playing something else. And then I just started Persona 3 and I gave him the control. I'm like, just play like half an hour. Just see if you like this. And of course, the first cutscene starts and it's like, that's pretty attention-grabbing.
The beginning of that game is, you can't just ignore that game. You don't sleep through the beginning of that game.
No. Anyway, but we got through some of the beginning stuff and, you know, you have the scene where Yukari has the gun on you and things like that. And Mitsuru comes, and it's all crazy. You get to school and all of that. And Thomas wound up really enjoying, as soon as we got to Iwatodai Dorm, just dancing with the sticks to the music.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, he's going to play this game. And
anyway, because that's what I was going to say, because your brother's a music guy, so it's like, I'm sure as soon as he hears some of the better tracks of that game, it's like, okay, fuck, I have to play this game just for the music.
So anyway, we got to the first save point, and he said, okay, I want to stop for now, because also he was on my profile, so he was never going to play the whole thing that way. And he was like, do you think I could emulate this on my computer? I'm like, oh, yeah, you totally could. Sean, that's how he played it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm you can get it if you have a DVD port in your or the DVD drive in your computer, you can just buy the PS2 disc and play that way.
Yeah, so I was like, yep. And he's like, right. And then Persona 4 I can play on the Vita. I'm like, yes, like those are the versions. And he's like, why can't I play the PSP version of Persona 3? And I explained that. I'm like, you know how you were dancing to the music? You can't do that in portable. If you want to, if you're playing it for like a second time, it's fine. But the first time, you want to be able to dance to the music and stuff.
And then on top of that, like, if hypothetically you are playing Persona 3 Fest on an emulator on your PC, maybe save states make it so that that's a really better experience in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I've never played it that way. So, anyway. But I just enjoyed that because I could kind of... You know, I don't know if he'll actually play them, but he's been interested because I will show him yourself. But, like, I'll load it up on my Vita. Like, look at Persona 4 the Golden. Look how fun this is.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, maybe I should play that. So, anyway. Yeah. So fear of missing out. It's a powerful thing. So
It has made me do some dumb shit in the past of, like... watching all of Doctor Who and that kind of stuff. Like, it has set me on some dark paths for sure in my life.
Anyway, so yeah. But I just want to tell that because you mentioned Nanako and I was like, I should tell that story.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. You know, I mean, we are Persona Podcast in form of kind name.
While we're on this topic, can I just tell a stupid story from our PS3 gaming session last night?
Sure, yeah.
One of the things I have on my PS3, because we bought it when we saw a Let's Play of this game. It's a really shitty... You know, they did that run on the 360 and PS3 where they made a bunch of those game shows like Wheel of Fortune, Jeopardy, into
video games. Yeah, like Trivial Pursuit.
Like really shitty, but they make for fun like Let's Plays and stuff.
Uh-huh.
We got the Family Feud version of that on the PS3.
Seen Let's Plays of that game, yeah.
And we play it sometimes when we just... Anyway, and I had my PS3 out. It wasn't even hooked up, but I like hooked it up and we were playing some of that. And two really funny things happened in that game that I have to share.
Okay.
Because they were hilarious. Because if you haven't seen the Family Feud video game, the way that works is that Family Feud, the game show, is that they give you a scenario and you have to guess words that were given in a survey, and you're guessing, like, what did the survey respondents say to this?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what is a fruit that people put in salads or something? And you would say grapes or whatever, and you'd see where that comes up. And in the game, you have to type in the word until it shows up, like, as one you can fill in, and then you press a button to fill in that word.
Yeah, so, as you start typing the word, it has, like, some, like, built-in answers, like, potential answers to the question that you can then pick quickly.
Right. And sometimes you'll say a word, like, let's say, animal... And the answer will be, like, dog. And it'll give you that. It'll just say, animal, dog, that's close enough. And it'll show animal, and then it'll flip around like the actual answer was dog. Well, one of the rounds, though, is when you win, you have this final round where it's like you do some rapid-fire answers, and you fill in your word, and it'll say if you're right or wrong, but it doesn't do that flip around of, like, what was the actual word.
Yeah.
Well, at some points, you just get goofy with this game, obviously, because no one's going to play this shitty game seriously.
Yeah.
So one of the things was... in that last survey part. It was, what's something that Shaquille O'Neal could not fit into, and it's not clothing? And of course, you're going to come up with a dumb answer for that, right?
Yeah, because the only answers to that question is a dumb answer.
Yes, and so I did a serious one first, but then they ask you again, and I wrote butt. He can't fit in a butt easily. I wrote B-U-T-T, butt. I got 56 points for that answer. That was the number one response, and I don't know if some programmer was goofing off,
yeah,
or if that ties to some card where like it turns around and it's underwear or something, but that doesn't seem right either. So that was hilarious. That alone, because
I mean, it is true. Like, yeah. You know, like, I mean, it's a weird answer because like no human being can fit in a butt. Like, that's ridiculous. But yeah.
So anyway, that was weird. Then the best part though was I beat Thomas 3 times in a row at this game, and I mean, shut him out. He got no points, and it was very humiliating. And at one point, he finally got to one that he thought he was going to do great at, because the question was, name a president who appears on money, and there were 4 answers. And he filled in Washington, he filled in Lincoln, and those were number 1 and 2. And then it's like, he's like, he starts thinking, what are the other presidents on money? So he did Jackson.
Yeah.
On the 20, wasn't part of the search. It wasn't one of the 4 top answers.
Sure, I can believe that because most people don't know that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this gets better. So, and I said, and then he's like, who should I fill in next? Should I fill in Grant? And I'm like, Thomas, I bet it's Benjamin Franklin. And he said, Franklin's not a president. I'm like, yeah, but this is a survey of real people, and nobody knows Franklin wasn't a president.
Everybody knows that Franklin is on the $100 bill.
Yes. I'm like, I guarantee you, if you get this, and he didn't put it in, he put in Grant, and he lost, and it passed to me, and I filled in Franklin, and then I said, I bet the other one is Hamilton, and it showed up, and it was Hamilton. And it was hilarious, because I nailed it so hard that this stupid survey, it would be the 2 presidents people know, Washington and Lincoln, and then 2 people who were in no way presidents, Hamilton and Franklin.
Yeah.
And it was, that made me laugh, and Thomas was mad for about 2 hours.
I mean, that's what you get for playing fucking Family Feud. I know. Like, Family Feud is the darkest, most depressing game humanity has ever made, because it is the game that the only way you win is by underestimating the public's intelligence.
Exactly. And see, I wasn't taking it seriously, so I had a great time.
Yeah.
Anyway, but that was a fun story. So, anyway, talk about Thumper.
Yes. Yes, so while you were off playing Family Feud, I was in the grips of death, hurtling through like metal hell as a metal scarab beetle on a track, hurtling towards some abstract leviathan shape on the horizon that was going to eat my soul. Because Thumper is a fucking brutal game. Like, it is the hardest game I've played this year for sure, and it is intense. So for people who don't know, Thumper is an indie game that it's available on kind of everything. It's on PS4, it's on PC, it's on all that good stuff. There's also a virtual reality version, which the idea of playing this thing in VR is like asking me to die. Like, I can't imagine what it would be like. But Thumper is basically a rhythm game that is very different from, I think, what people would think of rhythm games today, or even, like, ever. We had, like, an era in the PS1 with Amplitude and stuff that were kind of, like, a bit different than something like a Guitar Hero or a Rock Band, but still are not quite like Thumper. But Thumper is essentially a rhythm game where the soundtrack is almost entirely percussion. The stuff that isn't percussion is just sort of, like, weird, like, kind of like ominous sound of just like a in the background. There's no like melody or anything, so it's all percussion, and you are playing as this like weird sort of metal scarab beetle on a track that is hurtling through like really weird abstract like weird like progressive metal album cover silver just shapes and shit, and just hurtling through that. And all the controls in the game are basically the X button and a direction. And so you either have to like hit X when a note thing comes at you that looks like kind of like a note from Guitar Hero, and hit that, and it makes like a boom noise. And then there are turns that you have to do when walls pop up. So you have to turn. And then there are just a number of different obstacles. They sort of like build up throughout the game of different things you need to do. But the fundamental controls are just you press X, or sometimes you press X in a direction, and that's it. What makes the game brutally difficult is, one, it is insanely oppressive, because it is just this cacophony of intense industrial percussion, and like, and it is just consumes you, and it is so intense, and the timing is so exacting, and as the game goes on, the things they like ask you to do of being able to kind of like having to parse the obstacles in front of you through the, like, visual miasma of all this shit coming at you and the intense colors and the way that everything is kind of, like, moving and weirdly abstract and kind of trying to, like, filter all that stuff out and see what's in front of you, and then also hear that whenever the obstacles pop up on the track, they make, like, a very distinct sound, and having to, like, and pick that out, and the timing they come out in the soundtrack is becomes really key when it comes becomes harder, and then just having to, like, deal with shit coming at you and having to just turn really sharply and then, like, maybe, like, turn four times in a row on the beat, and it's a really intense game, and it's kind of hard to describe how much it just sort of, like, consumes your attention while you're playing it, because it takes that sort of space you are in when you're playing a rhythm game like a Dancing All Night or Guitar Hero, Rock Band, whatever, and you're playing one of those games on a, like, on your hardest difficulty that you can reasonably do, and you know how, like, you get, like, in the zone and you're super into it and you're grooving, and for those games, like, you're in the zone and you're having fun because you're, like, really feeling the music. In Thumper, when you are in the zone, it feels like you are in the zone, but you are, like, desperately clinging on to life. Because in this game, like, it is, like, if you can take one hit of, like, missing an obstacle, but, like, on the second hit, you are dead. And you, like, fucking explode and restart at the beginning. And the way the game is presented is when you get to the end of a level, or, like, there's a mid-boss, like, halfway through levels, you fight a boss that is, like, this weird shape that appears on the horizon, and then you have to defeat the boss, basically perform these sections flawlessly, and then when you get to the end of a section, and if you've hit all the things along the way, you can then hit the last note, and then that, like, launches a projectile at the boss, and you have to do that four times in a row to sort of defeat the boss. So it is kind of like a weird, almost like rhythm combat game in a way, of, like, shit, the way it's sort of presented to you. And it's something I've never seen a game like it. It is so, like, it was something where when I would finish a level, because the levels are actually fairly long, like, they're, like, especially the harder ones at the end where you die multiple times trying to get through a section, they can be, like, 15 to 20 minutes long of just, like, they're split up into discrete sections, and if you just try to play a whole level through to completion in one sitting, like, it is, like, a good 20, 30 minutes kind of thing. And by the time, like, I beat to, like, a level 5 or level 6, because there's some 9 levels in the game, like, I would put the controller down and, like, my heart was pumping and my hands hurt. Not because of, like, you know, I had to press all these things super fast, but it was more just, like, I was gripping the controller so hard that my hands were just, like, tensed up and, like, sore. And I would have to, I could only play one level of the game at a time, because if I didn't, like, my thumbs would just hurt too much and I couldn't play the game. It is a really, really awesome game. It is really difficult, but it is incredibly smartly designed, because it's not just that it's a singular kind of game that you've never seen before, but the way that it sort of sets up over the course of a level different kind of, like, phrases, musical phrases, like percussive musical phrases for you to complete, and they kind of build on that, and there's this sense of each level being, like, this really long, weird song that, like, you are seeing the same kinds of things coming up at you, of, like, going, like, boom, ba-dum-bum, ba-dum-bum-bum-bum, ba-dum-bum, and then it sort of moves into a different thing, and then halfway through that bum, ba-dum-bum part comes up again, but then, like, maybe at the end, it, like, adds another thing onto it, and then that starts building over the course of that level, and then oftentimes, like, it's teaching you little things of, like, how they can put the different obstacles together in different configurations to ask you to do different things, that then by the time you get to the end of, like, level 9 felt like this weird, like, sort of, like, epiphany moment for me, of where I actually, like, completed level 9 pretty easily, in the sense of, like, I didn't, even if I, like, I would get through this section kind of battered, I didn't, like, straight up die much while going through that level, because it felt like the game had taught me everything I needed to know, and now it was just putting all that knowledge to the test, and it felt so satisfying to go through a thing and see, like, oh, I know what this thing is, because this is just a more difficult version of this, like, phrase they used in level 4, and I just have to, like, put that together, and then, like, string that together with, like, this kind of idea they had in level 6 is, like, now put on the end of it. And so it is, like, a really, really smartly designed game in a lot of ways, and how it plays with, like, musical time and asking you to sort of, like, change, like, kind of, like, what beat you're working on in the middle of a section to sort of, like, stay with it and figure out what the game is asking you to do. And then ultimately it also culminates in a final boss battle where the mechanic behind it, I don't want to spoil what they do, but it is an inspired choice in how they mix up what the, like, last boss of the game does, and how he changes the way you need to sort of predict what is coming at you is so fucking smart and awesome. And beating that level, which I beat like 2 or 3 days ago, was a really like gratifying moment this year in games for me. Yeah. Just being like, fucking yeah, I beat this game. I'm the master of this game because this game was kicking my ass for 2 days.
Awesome.
Yeah, Thumper's really, really good. I had a great time with it.
Nice. And it is not about the character from Bambi.
No. I mean, maybe it is. Like, maybe this is, like, that would be great if at the end of the credits it just cut to, like, Thumper from Bambi, like, waking up from a nightmare and being like, I need to stop eating those shrooms. Like, this is shit. Shit.
Nice. All right. Well, that sounds fun. Okay, a couple more games to talk about, and I'm doing, this is in no particular order, but the next game that was the big release this week that is going to make a certain company an unholy amount of money is Super Mario Run on the iPhone.
Yes.
Came out this week, sort of long awaited, finally came out. And if you haven't seen anything about this game yet, it's pretty simple. It's a Mario game. It's in the visual style of the new Super Mario Bros. Games, but it is sort of in the style of an endless runner, but also not, because Mario does run on his own, but there are discrete levels.
Yeah.
And basically the only thing you do is you press a button to jump, although again, that's more complex than it looks like on the surface. The game has a couple different modes. You can get it for free and play the first 3 levels, but then you can unlock the whole game, which is 6 worlds of 4 levels apiece, plus the Toad Rally stuff, which is this like online, local versus sort of thing. And then you can also build your own little Mushroom Kingdom, which is also how you get unlockables, which I think is cool. And you can get all of that for $10. And so yeah, that's Super Mario Run. Have you played any of it yet?
Yeah, I've only played the free version, so okay. I played the first 3 levels. I put like a fair amount of time in that. I got the, I completed all 3 of the coin challenges on the first level and like the first 2 on the second. I'm not sure how much more time I'm going to put into it, but
yeah. Well, yeah, and I have not. I've played at least 3 of the worlds in total because I bought the whole game, and then I've played a bunch of Toad Rally because I'm trying to get my Toad so I can unlock Luigi. But anyway, I really like it. I'm surprised. I think this is not like a great Mario game or anything necessarily, obviously, because was it going to be?
Yeah.
But I think like as an adaptation for a mobile phone platform, I'm very impressed with it, and it seems very smart. And my quippy tweet about this is it feels like the direct qualitative inverse of Pokemon Go.
Sure.
This feels like a game that people put time and effort into. It plays very well on the phone.
It represents the franchise in a good way instead of Pokemon Go, like, in a weird way, kind of portraying what that franchise is about.
Indeed. Like, this is kind of what I would want from a Mario game on a phone. I think it's clever, and I think it's a lot more complex than it looks like on the surface, because at first you see, oh, Mario's going to run left to right, and you do some jumping, and that's it. And actually, no, like, they immediately start complicating that in the way a real Mario game complicates its own mechanics constantly from the very beginning. So, you know, there's stuff where you're jumping off walls and trying to go backwards, and there's little pause tiles that will make you stop for a minute, and you can decide where to go. And collecting coins is much more important in this game than it is in most Mario games, because you use those coins in the other modes.
The coins as money. Yes, which is like, it's mind-blowing that you realize, like, oh, right, like, coins are supposed to be the currency in this world, somehow.
Exactly. So there's a lot of ways I think they complicate it. You can go and do those coin challenges, which add a whole other layer to how you're playing the game. Mario, it's not just a singular jump, like the time you hold down determines how far he will jump. You can also, in the air, hit it again, and he'll do this little spin that'll allow, kind of like Little Mario does in Mario World, that will allow him to kind of stay in the air for a second longer. Yeah. So I feel like there's a good amount of strategy. Like, it really all does come back to that point of, like, this is how I would want a Mario game to work on the iPhone, where I'm not playing it with the same kind of attention that I maybe am, you know, Super Mario World on the Super NES, because you can't do that on an iPhone. I'm sorry, there's not buttons. You can't get into that level of complexity. But with the level of simplicity, it feels like everyone at Nintendo looked at that and took the opportunity to do something new with it. And I really like that. It's like, it's kind of exactly, as I said, what I would want out of a Mario game on an iPhone, in that I feel like there's a lot of fun stuff here. I'm only halfway through the main campaign, if you want to call it that, so I've got a lot more levels to play. And then I think the Toad Rally thing is fairly interesting as a way to keep you coming back, because in Toad Rally, the whole idea is that you basically are playing other people's, like, ghost runs of the level and competing with them. But it's not just the identical levels from campaign. Like, they've taken those levels and they will have remixed them in different ways.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool. And then you can use the stuff you get from there to build your different buildings, and that's how you unlock characters like Luigi and Toadette and things like that. So I like all of that, and I'm impressed with this. It's got really good music. The graphics look really nice on the iPhone. It runs really smoothly. I haven't had any problems with it. It's a good mobile game, and I feel like if your expectation was for it to be something different than that, that's a little weird to me. Like, I will say, the dumbest thing I've read about this game so far was in Polygon's review, which they put up like 2 hours after it came out. So good job rushing that one, Polygon.
But anyway, I mean, you could get through the game in 2 hours.
Sure, but anyway. There was a point on the day this launched where Polygon, you know how they have that like panel at the top with all their top stories? Every single one of them was Mario Run.
Yeah.
They chase SEO like a fucking Coke fiend.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Anyway, but the last line of their review was like, Mario Run is pretty good as a mobile game, but you know, if you want to play Mario's Best Adventures, you're going to have to look elsewhere. And I'm like, well, the doy, Polygon. Yeah, this isn't Mario World 2. I'm really sorry you were so disappointed that this isn't the best Mario game. So anyway, that just annoyed me. But as a $10 Mario game for my iPhone that now I can play wherever I go, I'm happy with it.
Yeah, I think it's fine. Like, it's something where it depends on, like you said, kind of like what your expectations are, what you're coming to it for. I will say, like, I'm really annoyed that you need to have an internet connection to play the game, because I'm going to be on a plane in like 4 or 5 days or something here, because I'm going on vacation around Christmas, and I can't play this game on the plane if I wanted to. And that's like,
it is the worst thing about the game.
Yeah, and so it's because it kind of like undermines the point of like it being this very simplistic Mario game that they are very insistent on letting you know that this is a Mario game that you can play with one hand. I don't know why that is all like, there's like a loading tip thing that says that, and that is also like the first line in the description in the iPhone store is, this is a Mario game you can play with your hand. And it's like, why do you want me to masturbate to Mario? What are you saying?
I really think it comes back to what Miyamoto said when he introduced it. I think Miyamoto just likes the idea of all the different things you could do while playing this, because think of the joy he had while pretending to eat a hamburger while playing Mario Run.
Unfortunately, there's only one thing that human beings think of doing while they have one hand free, and that is masturbating.
It is
like, it's a weird sort of miscommunication somewhere along the lines of like, this is not implying what you think it's implying. It's like, really not. But yeah, like the simplicity of it is nice, but it sort of is self-defeating if I can't play it on the go reliably, which is like it is a game that like is 100% you just play it while you're like on the toilet. Like that is all this game. That is the only place you are ever going to play this game, because you're not going to sit around and just play Super Mario Run, because it isn't that involving. It's kind of slow and plotting and stuff. It's just,
I've been fine. I mean, I everywhere I've gone with it, I can play it. But yeah, I mean, you're right. If you're in a special scenario like a plane or something, or the subway, which is more regular for people who don't live in Denver, you know, then yeah, I mean, that is frustrating, and I hope maybe they find a way to patch that out or something. But
I mean, it's there for like piracy reasons, so yeah. they're not going to patch it.
But it's so bizarre because I don't think they quite understand how iPhone encryption works. You don't need that there for piracy reasons. It's a weird thing. Like the iPhone has its own piracy protection on this stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't get it.
It's weird.
Like, I could understand that in the Android version of this, because that's a much more open platform. I still wouldn't think it would be smart. I'm just saying, like, but that's why you choose Apple to do this, is it's a closed platform that is hard to get into that way. So the always online thing just is bizarre. Yeah. Anyway.
But you can play the first three levels for free. Like, I've gotten my time out of them. Just, like, I made sure to do the first level and do the three. Because each level, there are 5 coins in them that are, like, in special places. So, like, the real challenge of playing a level is not just, to beat it, but to get the 5 coins. And then after you do that, it does 5, like, purple coins. And after you do the 5 purple coins, it's 5 black coins. So it sort of, like, increases the challenge. And so I did that on the first level just to see. It's like, is this something I'd be more interested in on, like, the higher levels of play? And it's, like, it's fine, but I'm probably not going to get the full version.
That's fine. I don't... The coin thing of collecting the special coins is not my favorite part of this.
Okay, yeah.
And it kind of run hot and cold on that in Mario games in general, because the first game to do that... Well, I guess that was Mario World. But in terms of, like, really investing in it.
New on Super- that, like, being, like, the real way to play the game.
Or like, the extra challenge that really, like, counts in the menu. It was New Super Mario Bros. And they've done that also in some of the 3D games. And some games I really like it. Like, I think Mario 3D Land on the 3DS, fantastic. It's a really fun thing to do in that game. And in other ones, like some of the New Super Mario Bros. Sequels, I have not found it all that entertaining. This is one where I'm like, not my favorite part, but I can still have fun playing through the levels. Toad Rally does something totally different with it, so I like it. It's a Mario game. My favorite series survived intact to the iPhone, and this is in no way a stain on the Mario legacy.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not that.
Which, you know, when I hear they're going to put Mario on the iPhone, that could very easily be a stain on the Mario legacy.
It's like, hey, man, you can play this game with one hand, so you can put as many stains on the Mario legacy you want.
Drop the mic on that one.
Yep.
All right. Let's move on. Yes. So, one piece of news, and then I'm going to talk about a few more games.
Okay.
But I forgot to do this up top.
All right.
We talked last week about the Fate of the Furious, the Fast and the Furious 8 movie that there was about to be a teaser for. That teaser actually came out as we were recording.
Yeah, that was like, as soon as we stopped recording that podcast and you went home, I like opened up my laptop and was like, oh, okay, I'll watch this trailer.
That trailer, it is so good, but it includes the line. Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, stares down Jason Statham, and he says, I'm going to beat you like a Cherokee drum.
Yeah.
Film of 2017. It's best good. Picture, it's, best screenplay.
It is a very, very good trailer.
It is so good. I guess your only experience with these movies is through the trailers.
It's through the trailers, and I enjoy it tremendously because there's something really funny about seeing the plots of these movies through that lens of, like, this one, the big one is that Vin Diesel is, like, he's betraying the family.
Yep.
I was just like, okay, great, yeah, that's the thing.
He's betraying the family, and they apparently tried to do what Die Another Day, the James Bond movie, did with having a big ice chase, only they're going to do it good. And so, like, there's the whole thing where they have, like, the submarine coming out of the ice and all this stuff. Look, Fast and the Furious has not dropped a beat since they got back on track with that fourth movie. And, man, I'm fucking excited.
Yeah. My favorite part about, like, experiencing this franchise only through the trailers is how, like, how much prominence The Rock has in these movies now. Of, like, the first, because he was in Fast 5 was the first one he was in. Like, I always got the impression from the trailer of that movie where I was like, oh, he's, like, the sort of villain of this movie and is probably, like, this is just going to be the one that he's in. And then, like, in each subsequent trailer, it feels like he's more and more becoming, like, the main character of these movies in a crazy way.
It's kind of, well, and he wasn't in 7 much because he wasn't he was shooting another movie, so he's only in the beginning and end of 7. But in the trailers, you wouldn't know that because they put a bunch of his big moments in. But it looks like they have him back for 8, which I think is great because he's become a great, like, him and Dom's bromance is so good. And actually, they couldn't have known this, but it's very fortuitous that they had The Rock, because now that Paul Walker is dead, you've lost that kind of bromance that was the heart of the movies. So now you can kind of transfer it to Vin Diesel and The Rock, and I love that you can do that. Because, you know, you got to have that heartwarming bromance alive. There is heterosexual love in these movies, but the love between these bros, that's what it's about.
It is about keeping the love in the family.
Absolutely. So there's some good stuff in that trailer. These movies just, you know, we can joke about them. It is one of Hollywood's best franchises, and I think they give it their all every single time.
It certainly seems like it.
And it looks like they are this time. I mean, there are some, also, like, obviously the thing with the submarine has to be CGI. I don't know how else you would do it. But some of the, like, practical stunts they do in these movies are pretty cool. And, like, the one they do in this where they all, like, hook their hooks onto Dom's car.
Yeah.
And then he's like, all right, we're doing this. And he just, like, spins out and he flips the two cars.
There's some, like, I feel like this one was heavier, or at least this trailer was heavier on the car stuff than it's been for the past couple of movies. And there's something I love about them, like, trying to keep the car thing central, even though it seems like that's not what these movies have been about for a long time now. But, like, there's something fucking hilarious to me about them being like, okay, we all have to, like, he's in a car, so we all have to get in cars and take his car down with our cars because we need better cars, but he has the best car. His car is better than, like, 7 of our cars. It's crazy. It's like they want to just use mechs, but they can't because they need it to be, like, set in contemporary America. So they just have them be cars, even if, like, for the plot purposes, they might as well just be fucking giant robots.
No, I mean, literally, the plot of the 6th movie was they're helping The Rock go after an international terrorist, and the whole, like, justification is he's a terrorist who drives fast cars, so they have to get in faster cars, and I love it, like, that's what makes these great, is that they just are what they are.
Yeah.
And they aren't apologizing for it. It's great. Yeah. So anyway, I'm excited for this movie. And I love that they make it really clear in that trailer at the end with the hashtag that the word fate is a pun on F8. I'm really sad that it's not called the F8 of the Furious.
I'm sure that, like, there will be poster treatments that have that title on it. Like, who knows what the fucking opening title card of the movie is going to actually be.
Oh, I found out something else that I want to tell you about the whole wrinkle of the titles of these movies.
Yeah.
Outside of the United States, the titles have just been, since the fourth movie, Fast and Furious 4, Fast and Furious 5, Fast and Furious 6, and this one is still just Fast and Furious 8. So I love that outside the U.S., it's just 4, 5, 6, 7,
they're not
8.
Dealing with that bullshit anymore.
Nope,
like,
it's
stop it, Americans. You're just getting obnoxious.
It's hilarious. It's just the U.S. where they're doing that.
Great.
So anyway, that's great.
I don't know what that says about the United States of America, but it probably says something good.
Yeah. Well, yeah, anyway. So let's go ahead and do my first topic of the day.
Okay.
And do a couple different topics here. And this topic I have called Winter Game Updates. Because I came home the other day, it was a Tuesday night, and I turned on my Xbox, I turned on my PS4 to try to get an update for something, and I saw three of my games were updating.
Yes.
Infinite Warfare, Modern Warfare Remastered, and Hitman were all getting updates, and they were big. And I'm like, I'm not playing PS4 for a while.
Yeah.
Turn that off and let it update. And I turned on my Xbox to play something, and Forza Horizon 3, Destiny, and Overwatch were getting updates. And of these six games that were updating, five of them were for their winter game updates. And I love that that is such a reliable tradition at this point.
Yeah.
I downloaded probably 50 gigabytes of data in one night that was just adding, like, Christmas trees to things.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty great.
Yeah.
So one of these in particular I want to talk about because it's an actual piece of DLC, and that's Forza Horizon 3, and we'll talk about that at the end. But I want to hit a couple of these other ones. Overwatch had a Christmas update. That's pretty fun. They added, like, Christmas trees and stuff to every map, and I love that.
Yeah.
And you have different Christmas costumes you can put on. And there's a new mode where you do May's snowball fight. And I don't know how much we've talked about Overwatch on here in a while, but May is, like, my main. I play as May as much as possible.
That is the right choice.
She's a great character. And I love that some people haven't liked it, but I think, like, it's just a stupid fun winter mode. It's fine where May has a snowball in her gun, and if you hit someone with a snowball, they die, and it's an elimination mode. And you
have
to go find...
That is an intense snowball fight.
Yep.
Jesus.
And you have to go find more pieces of snow to make your snowballs, but you also still have your ice walls and stuff, so... It is pandemonium. I like it. It's fun. So that's good. It's Overwatch. It's great. It's, you know, I will say Overwatch is obviously one of the games that is on my list of, like, contenders for my top 10.
Yeah,
I'll
say
that. And I don't know, I'm not going to tell you where it wound up, in or out or whatever, but I've gotten back into it in the last couple weeks just because I've been playing it with my brother a little more because I came out of my Final Fantasy 15 rabbit hole and I'm like, I can interact with people again. So we played some Overwatch, and I think I've been taking this game for granted a little bit. When you really look at just how good the basic gameplay is, how fun it is consistently, how much strategy and simplicity there is to it at the same time, and how celebratory it can be in events like these where you can have this winter game update and on the front it's, you know, Torbjorn in a Santa costume and everyone's just huddling around a fire hugging. That's really fun. And I think that, you know, this is one of the very few games this year that is a new IP and people have embraced it to that level and it is out there just having fun with itself to that level. I love Overwatch. It's a cool game.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Blizzard having fun with the winter as they should.
Yes.
All right. Destiny, I haven't played, but I know that had a Christmas update.
Yeah, I haven't picked it up in a while.
Yeah, Destiny's Christmas updates are usually terrible, so I haven't done anything with that.
Yeah, I feel like they're bringing back, like, the Sparrow Racing something or whatever.
Yeah.
I feel like they talked about it at PSX. I don't know.
Modern Warfare, its big update this week was for adding in all the maps that were not in the launch version.
So now it has
the whole multiplayer suite, which is neat. I've been playing some of that. Like, I've actually played more Modern Warfare multiplayer than Infinite Warfare multiplayer.
I'm in the same position.
Because it's better.
Yeah.
And, you know, that game fucking holds up.
Yeah.
The one winter, they did add a winter Christmas map, which I think is funny. I don't know if that was in the original game anywhere.
Yeah, I don't remember.
But they did something with that. I have not found, I played it locally a little bit because it still has local, like, split screen play and stuff, which is neat. So yeah, that's kind of cool. The one funny thing with Modern Warfare is that I had a suspicion about this, so I went in and checked on the back end with my PS4. Modern Warfare Remastered now takes up more of my hard drive than Infinite Warfare.
Yeah.
And I want someone to explain to me how that's the case.
I mean, they completely redid all the graphics and stuff of Modern Warfare Remastered, so it's not like the basics of the game like take a smaller digital footprint than Infinite Warfare would. It is kind of weird when you think about like Infinite Warfare has all the like zombie mode stuff on top of it. You'd think it would still be
and
more
just
data.
The scale of what that game is doing is bigger, so it's a longer campaign. It's got more things in it anyway, but it's fine.
But Modern Warfare Remastered has more maps.
That's true, I guess. Yeah, but that's like got a solid 60 gigs on my hard drive. Infinite Warfare sitting there at like 58. So eventually there will be DLC, and if you get all of that, I'm sure it will be bigger. But I don't care about that unless it's campaign DLC. I'd play like a mini mode.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect them to do that.
They won't. Yeah. I know, but maybe they just decide we're going the Naughty Dog route.
Fucking yeah.
Call of Duty Infinite Warfare Left Behind.
Yes.
It's all about Lieutenant Salter.
Yes, I would play that. Yeah. Absolutely.
Anyway, but that's that. Hitman had a new mission in Paris.
Yeah, they put on a bonus Christmas mission in Paris where you go around and you have to kill the villains from Home Alone, which is amazing. There's something kind of insane about that. Like, they have broken into the Paris mansion from the Paris map, and they are going around the map stealing these special items that are items from, like, all the other maps of, like, the circumcision knife from Sapienza and, like, the coconuts from Bangkok, and I think there's, like, 12 items that they're trying to steal.
Yeah.
And so one of the main challenges is for you to sort of, like, figure out where all those items are and take them before they do, and then they will go somewhere, and you can kill them, and that's the real way to play that mission. Otherwise, if you don't do it that way, it's just, like, here's two targets on Paris map has Christmas trees on it. Like, it's not that big of an update. But you, like, try to get the four challenges that are in it, like, that's where the real content is.
Okay, yeah, I didn't play it that deeply. I thought their redress of the Paris map was A+.
Yeah.
Very funny and fantastic.
Yeah, also Santa is, like, there's some sort of ethereal Santa that pops up in that map that you have to kind of track down to get the Santa costume.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, like, you can kill actual, like, mystical Santa Claus. It's not just a guy in a Santa Claus outfit. It is Father Christmas himself.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, it's a pretty basic, like, update because it doesn't have any new voice acting or anything. But, I did not play it that deeply, but I think it's kind of fun that they did that.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Because it's free, so, like...
Yeah, yeah, totally. Hitman, that Paris map has, on its own, more content than most $60 games this year.
Yeah. Also, the new Elusive Target is up, and I haven't played it yet, and I really want to play the Elusive Target on Hitman.
Yeah, I resent the Elusive Targets at this point. They just keep foiling me. Maybe I'll try this one.
Yeah,
I finally get him. Where is this guy?
I want to say this one is a Sapienza one.
Okay, I haven't had a Sapienza one yet. That could be fun.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, so that's those winter game updates. But really, this is just me doing some prelude to talk about Forza Horizon 3, which added its first big piece of DLC this week, which is the Blizzard Mountain DLC, and it is spectacular.
Cool.
I will say, like, I will just say my overall thoughts up front, which is that Forza Horizon 3 is on my top 10. I can spoil that. It's a great game. But where I had it in my draft after playing Blizzard Mountain, it went up at least one spot.
Cool.
Because this is the best thing about this game is the Blizzard Mountain DLC. It is better than anything in the base game. And that is such a rare thing to get to say about a piece of DLC.
Yeah.
But, like, this is as close as a racing game could ever come to the Naughty Dog model of DLC. Like, it is basically, like, Left Behind style, where the DLC is separate. Like, you go somewhere else. It's not an extension of the main Forza Horizon 3 map. Like, you literally have to get on a plane in your car, and they take you somewhere else. And it is its own map. It is its own separate thing. It even has its own ranking system, so that it doesn't mess with your ranking system back in the main Australia map. Which I think is smart, because that means it's not going to split the player base online or anything like that. It also means that, like, you don't have to worry about how this interacts with your other achievements and challenges and stuff. It is its own thing. So that's what I mean of just, it's like a separate thing. Just like The Last of Us Left Behind is not part of The Last of Us.
Yeah.
It's its own thing. I just thought that was a funny way to think of it, because they really approach it as its own piece of content. And it is huge. Like, it's a really big map section, and it's awesome. But also, it is more content-rich than any individual part of the main game. Like, it has more maps and more, like... If you take the individual parts, because there's like four zones in the main Forza Horizon 3 on the map, and each of those has their own races and stuff associated with it. I'm pretty sure Blizzard Mountain has a significant amount of more races and things to do than any of those individual four zones have in the main game. And those individual races, I feel like, are just superior in most ways to, like, just in terms of how they are imagined and laid out and stuff like that. Because I've been playing this mostly online co-op with my brother, who's home now, so we're, like, a room apart shouting at each other, which is fun. It's not a game, obviously, you can play, like, split screen or anything. Yeah. That'd be weird. But, like, online sometimes is harder because you don't have your rewind feature, and sometimes I feel like the races are a little too demanding or something. I haven't had that problem at all with this. Like, it's really fun and intuitive no matter what. And, of course, the big draw is that unlike the main Australia map in Forza Horizon 3, this is Blizzard Mountain. It is in the winter. There is snow everywhere. There are dynamic weather conditions that change, so you will be in a full-on, like, blizzard where you can't see, like, a foot in front of your car. That's just, it's a bright, sunny day. And I can say with confidence, this has been a year with a lot of great graphics in video games. This is the year I feel like the next generation properly arrived.
Right.
Forza Horizon 3 Blizzard Mountain blows everything else out of the water. It is, like, the most gorgeous thing I've ever seen in a video game. And it is also, like, the most photorealistic in some ways, where, obviously, we live in Colorado. I know what it's like to drive in a fucking blizzard.
I've
seen conditions like this all my life. I learned to drive. I got my license in the dead of winter.
Yeah.
So this is, like, my fucking life. And it looks so true to what these things look like. Just the way, like, light plays off the snow, and the way your car does trails through the snow, and the way, like, on a road you'll have it somewhat, you know, sanded or something, and there'll be black ice and things like that. It's all rendered just so perfectly, but also, like, this whole environment is so beautiful, every part of it. Like, just exploring this map is the funnest part of it. Like, even if you're not doing the races or anything like that, just driving around and doing tricks and seeing different parts of the map where you might be climbing the mountain, or you might be down kind of in the valley where there's a town, or there's a big frozen lake you can just go do donuts on and stuff. Or if you climb high enough into the mountain, there's a whole hot springs that you can drive through and things like that. It is unbelievably gorgeous. They've even upped how good, like, the cloud animations and the way sun breaks through the clouds, all of that is even better. It is amazing. And, you know, I said this about the base game. If Forza Horizon 3 was just pretty graphics, it would still be one of the achievements of the year because the graphics are that good. But the gameplay is so good, and the amount of variety in what you can do is so high. And as an online experience, it is so fluid. Everything about it is so good, and I feel like the Blizzard Mountain DLC brings out the best in it so hard. And actually having that snow driving and forcing you to customize your vehicles a little more makes the game feel deeper and better, too. So it is really good. If you have this game, this DLC is an absolute must-buy. It's only $20, and I feel like that's actually a really good deal for the amount of content they give you.
Right.
And you can get a season pass that's $35, so I assume they're going to do a second one of these. I just bought this a la carte, but I am definitely excited to see whatever else they do next. Like, this is the kind of thing where if this DLC came out next year, I would have to consider this for year-end accolades.
Oh, jeez.
But as just its own part of Forza Horizon 3, it, like, sweetens the whole package for my year-end considerations, because this is just a hell of a racing game. And if you are approaching, you know, this game, it's just, this is, I'm here to have fun with this. This is one of the best experiences of 2016, and this DLC just makes it better. So,
awesome.
Love it. Yeah. If you have an Xbox One, I am confident in saying Forza Horizon 3 is the best exclusive on that platform. And that's pretty rare you get to say that about a racing game. That's not a genre.
Yeah, I mean, especially these days. Like, yeah, there are a few far between.
This is something we're going to talk about next week with our year-end accolades and stuff, but there are a lot of games in genres that felt stale that were not stale this year.
Yeah.
And did new things, and I feel like this is one of them, just being the best version of itself. So, Blizzard Mountain. Fucking great.
Awesome.
Yeah. So anyway, that's that. Let's go ahead and move on to some of our main topics. You want to hit some Infinite Warfare spoilers?
Yeah, let's talk about some Call of Duty Infinite Warfare. I've been wanting to talk about this game for like a month and a half now.
Yeah, so we're going to do spoilers from this point out. We'll talk about Infinite Warfare, then we'll talk about Rogue One. If you have not played or watched either of those things, we will be spoiling them.
Yes.
You can decide whether that bothers you or not. But Infinite Warfare 3, 2, 1, everybody dies.
Everybody dies, except Salter does not die.
Salter does not die. And no, three other people we don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I love that detail of, like, four people survive the end, and you see Salter in the last cutscene, but, like,
yeah.
Yeah, basically everyone dies in this game except for one person who lives to tell the tale and repeat the cycle.
Yes, and I will just say, the thing that got me hardest about this ending, before I got to, like, the credits, was the intelligence of early in the game, you are Nick Reyes, the main character, yeah. and you're walking through that main building, mm-hmm. and you see that wall of heroes where they've listed
memorial.
The memorial. They've listed the name of the dead, and one of the pillars is empty. There are no names on it. And at first I just saw that as like an innocuous, if you've ever been to a war memorial, they do that.
Yeah.
And they leave space empty, and I'm like, that's a nice detail that they left a wall empty, you know? But at the end of the game, the last scene is Salter looking at that empty wall, but now it's filled with the names of your characters.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of economy of storytelling that you were talking about. To me, that is representative of everything this game does well.
Exactly. Like, it does like incredibly subtle foreshadowing. It presents an idea, and then it like complicates it later in the story, and it has a cyclical nature to the storytelling in ways that are both bigger, but are also like really subtle. Of like, I can totally see someone playing that whole game and never realizing, oh, this is the memorial I walked past at the beginning of the game. Because that is after the sort of like prologue thing that sets up the conflict. That is like when you're controlling Reyes, the first thing you do is you walk through that room past this like Vietnam memorial looking like these plaques on these walls. And like that sets up this. What it sets up is that Reyes and Salter kind of know what that is, and they kind of like they make a comment on it. But you, the player, have no. Because since it's set in the future, like it's not a real war memorial, you don't have no perspective on like who these memorials are commemorating, like what it is for, like what conflict, what war, what battle. You don't know any of that stuff. And so there's something about when you come around to the end of the game, and now, like as you said, that last slab has been filled with like all the names of the people on your crew. You realize like all those other slabs had this story in them. And, like, it is this cycle of war and of these soldiers giving their lives that, like, is not done. Like, it's going to keep on happening. That, like, and you just saw this one version of that story of how these names got there. And, like, that is the, like, everything in this game feels like it is there to give you this, like, real emotional impact at the end of, like, realizing kind of, like, the scope of the issues that the game is addressing. That it's, like, it's something so much bigger than just this individual story. It is about warfare. It is about like, and it is about soldiers and their war or in their role in war and like what we ask of them to do.
Yes.
And like, and I think the game has really complicated feelings on that, because it is one, like these people are amazing and they do amazing things, and oftentimes they can like do amazingly good things and really help people, but then also like we are sending them all to die, you know, like and we are creating these scenarios in which, like, they have to go die. Like, there's nothing we can do about it. And I feel like the game, I've seen some reviewers and reactions to the game criticizing the game as being, like, an ooh-rah military thing. And I'm like, I do not know what fucking game you were playing, but, like, that is not the story I saw. Like, there's nothing I got. When I was at the end of this game, I was not like, oh, this is amazing. Like, I'm going to sign up for the fucking Marines. I got to the end of this game and I was like, I was almost crying because of like how much it impacted me and like making you sort of face up to what society needs like some of our best people to do and what we do to them. Like that is what the game is about.
Yeah, and I don't think it's ooh-rah military, but I think, and I say this 100% sincerely, it is the most respectful of soldiers I have ever seen a video game be. And I think Call of Duty, you know, they obviously have a lot of military people on board to help make these games. They have always been respectful in terms of trying to portray certain things accurately.
Yeah.
But I do, to me, the Call of Duty games have generally been pretty gross in their depiction of war.
Post Call of Duty 4.
Yeah.
I thought Call of Duty 4 did a very good job in that climate of stuff like the AC-130 mission and stuff, like kind of presenting a more complex view of that stuff.
Yeah, the original games like 2, 4, I think those are very respectful in certain ways. But past that, it's Michael Bay movies where even the people you're playing as don't matter, and it's telling you they don't matter because it just swaps them out for a moment where it's just a shock kill.
Yeah.
And that is inherently disrespectful because you're saying that all soldiers matter as are shock kills. And that's what a lot of Call of Duty does. So when I say this game feels like a direct repudiation of what this series has been doing, that's what I mean. And I think it's seeding that from the very beginning, and that the opening scene is a player character dying, which I initially laughed at because I'm like, oh, it's called the first thing that happens is your character dies. But immediately it starts contextualizing that, because what happens is that's a video that Nick Reyes is watching.
Yeah.
And that's something he is thinking about. And then you walk past the war memorial. And, you know, I lived in Washington, D.C. when I was between the ages of 5 and 6. So a long time ago, but I do remember certain things. And one of the most humbling things you will ever see in your life is the Vietnam War Memorial, if you've ever been to that. Yeah. It is like I said, just humbling is the only word I can think of. And I think that kind of imagery is very powerful. And if you're going to use it, I think you have to use it respectfully. I think other Call of Duty games have not. I think this game uses it incredibly respectfully. And it goes on to tell a story that, while it is out in space and it is scale-wise the biggest thing Call of Duty has ever done, it is also, I think, the most grounded human story they've ever told, because it is about the very literal human cost of what these people are doing and what death in war means. And because it assigns meaning to those deaths and it says those deaths matter, that is why it is respectful. And most, you know, war shooters, not just Call of Duty, they do not tell you death matters. You know, I mean, in the Modern Warfare series, you go from the first game ends with Captain Price dying to the third game, he's come back to life, and he's just, you know, kicking dudes' asses, and you're playing as him now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that arc is something that, at some point, someone's going to write some thesis about, you know?
Yeah.
And Infinite Warfare is such a smart repudiation of that ideology, I think.
Yeah, and it's something where, like, talking about the space setting, it is something where I feel like the story that they tell is enabled because they remove it from, like, the grounded reality that we are immediately familiar with. And I think it is in a, like, tradition of military science fiction. For me, like, the biggest point of similarity is the original Mobile Suit Gundam series from 1979, which tells, like, a very similar, like, yeah, like, we are in space, but, like, we are still humans. We are still doing what we are doing. We're just doing it in a more, like, disgusting, kind of gruesome way because of, like, what technology has enabled. And that is, like, what this game, a lot of, like, the technology in this game is this, like, early space age, like, we don't really know what we're doing. Like, we are firing fucking, like, particle beams at people and blowing them up. And it's, like, some of the shit you do in this game feels like this is something, like, 20 years after this game is set, is going to be a war crime. Like, shooting people out into space with their fucking, like, spacesuits on. Like, that's going to be a war crime in this universe at some point. Because, like, this is really fucked up.
It's what you're doing. It's something that needs to be talked about with this game is that the lore is so smart. Like, it feels like they really considered what this world and this story they are telling is. And, like, this is almost like the World War I of this future.
Exactly,
where the things they're doing, as you say, by the time of, like, the World War II, you'd look at it and say, that's barbaric, we're not doing
that. Yeah, this is, like, it's like using mustard gas. It's like, no, you can't do that. Like, that's just wrong on, like, a deeper level than anything else that we're doing here.
Right. And just, I think, you know, the whole... It's funny, because I got my brother to start playing this, because I said, Thomas, while you're home, you need to play this game. And he's been playing it. And at first, he was like... And I can understand this. If you've only played a couple hours, you might not yet get why it's special.
Yeah.
And he was saying, I don't really get what the whole SDF is. And I said, you'll get it. It's you know, it's not the most developed part of the game, but I do think it's interesting, and I think he's gotten to that point. And what I think is interesting about the SDF is this idea that I don't see confronted in this kind of future space stuff all that much, which is that, what if we went into space and we weren't united? You know, this to me is alternate version of Star Trek. Where, like, Star Trek is, we got out there because we united ourselves.
Yeah.
Call of Duty Infinite Warfare is we got out there in spite of ourselves, and then we broke again. And I feel like I can definitely buy the whole SDF thing here.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Especially given current events on this planet of getting out there and descending into fascism and saying, fuck it, we were born on Mars, why does Earth matter anything to us? We're going to fucking kill those people.
Yeah.
Because that's what humans do.
Yeah.
So, I buy it 100%.
Yeah, I mean, without the fascism stuff, I mean, a lot of ways, like, what the SDF is doing is, like, it's kind of the American Revolution. Like, when you think about it, of, like, you know, they don't get super deep into the politics of, like, the overall scenario in this game, because they don't need to, but it is, like, a... If you send these people off to, like, the fucking colonies on Mars, but then the Earth government still has ultimate, like, jurisdiction over them politically, like, those people are eventually going to say, fuck you, like, we have all of our space mining equipment, we're, like, mining, like, heavy metals in Jupiter's atmosphere and on asteroids, like, we have, like, because that's one of the things is the SDF amasses a much larger space fleet than the Earth forces, because they have access to all this, like, industrial material that Earth doesn't, because Earth is this closed system. And so then they come and they fight us. And it's like, it is, like, I think there are some places where the game could have gone slightly into more detail of, like, maybe providing a little bit more stuff that, like, if you wanted to explore on the terminal, get a little bit deeper into that stuff. But overall, I do think the setting is very convincing. It sort of works off of a military science fiction template that already exists in kind of, like, takes it for itself, and I really like that part of the game. There's one really minor quibble I have, is I don't like that they have these, like, warp drive-looking things for their, like, big capital ships that, like, they, like, warp out of systems. I wish that they just used normal engines, because it's, like, that's the one part of the technology that's not really believable to me. But, like, that's a super minor point of, like, it's just a...
Sure.
It's like, a quick sort of, like, visual reference, because people know what, like... moving between planets and science fiction looks like, so they just kind of like use that visual language. But that's like the only part in the sort of like the setting that doesn't really work 100% for me.
Yeah, but like, you know, you were talking about this, and I think it is the most interesting thing about the game that winds up being underdeveloped is that revolution idea where,
yeah.
Again, they're doing it in a very fascist way, where the American Revolution was specifically for, you know, more a free Republican yeah. democracy. But it is, they are specifically doing callbacks to, like, the American Revolution of, instead of across a sea, it's across a solar system.
Yeah.
And we have these materials, why would you be taxing us on that or something? And, you know, they probably have some very reasonable grievances that they've blown out of proportion.
Yeah.
But you are fighting not on the side of the revolutionaries, and that's actually a very interesting thing to me. And I think... You talked about, like, maybe what if you did a game in this universe where you were from the side of one of the Martians? That
yeah.
would be interesting, I think, if you did that in a way of, like, you know, maybe what are they doing picking up the pieces after this game or something like that. Because
yeah.
I actually think, like, for instance, Salen Koch, the Admiral,
yeah.
is an interesting character to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's not all that developed because I don't know how you could do that in this setting. He can't be. Because that's the other thing is you have to keep it from the perspective of Nick Reyes and his team. You
yeah.
can't know more than they do.
Yeah, yeah.
And the game keeps you from knowing more than they do. But I do find those characters interesting. I don't think Salen Koch is just a generic big bad.
No.
He's yeah. fighting for something he very clearly... believes in a very kind of creepy way.
Yeah, it is something where it's one of the other criticisms largely about the story of the game that I really don't agree with is people being like, oh, like, the villains are, like, undeveloped in, like, single-dimensional. And it's like, I do think there is more to them than people are giving them credit for. But then also, like, it is not this story is not the place to develop them. Like, there's this weird ideal that I think people have that, like, in every story, every character has to be, like, super well-rounded and super complex and has their own character arc that they go off of. It's like, you can't do that. Like, that's how you tell a bad story, because that's how you get, like that era of, like, American television where every single fucking character has to have an episode B-plot in every single episode, or, like, a character B-plot in every single episode, and, like, you're trying to develop every character, and you make this, like, really unfocused story, or it's like, this story... One of the things I like about it is the villain is the villain. You like they give you enough to sort of justify his existence, and you can believe that this character would exist in this world. But like, other than that, why would Nick Reyes have to find out anything more about this dude? Like, why would he it's not important to the story that they're telling. Like, what's important to the story they're telling is Reyes and his group of people and his relationship with his soldiers under his command. It is not about the enemy. Like, the enemy could be fucking anybody in the story in this game, as long as it was believable, and that would be fine. Like, I'm really frustrated by people just... Like, it feels like they're criticizing the story by going down a checklist of, like, oh, well, this kid, like, the villain's not really complexly developed. And it's like, not every story needs a complicated villain. Sometimes that is a bad thing for the story because it draws too much focus away from what the story is really about. In this case, I thought it was smart that they just go with, like, yeah, like, he's a kind of character that fits in an archetype that you can understand really quickly, and then that's all you really need to know about him.
And he's intimidating and has a good presence.
Yeah.
Like, the actor is Kit Harington.
Yeah, he's a Game of Thrones guy.
Yeah, and I actually thought it was very clever against type casting, because that is very much not the character he plays on Game of Thrones. And I think taking that, his kind of stiltedness almost, and putting it in this like role of a bad guy who clearly is off in some way... is interesting, and I found him intimidating in a good way where he says pretty crazy things like surrender yourself for immediate execution,
yeah.
but he says it in such a committed way, that's why he's intimidating.
Yeah.
And again, as you say, that's what matters. This is a story about soldiers and their sacrifices, and what does Nick Reyes actually need to know? It's that those people represent a fucking existential threat to everything he holds dear.
Yeah.
That's why he's out there fighting. Like, at some point, to him, it doesn't really matter whether, you know, Salen Koch's father abandoned him or something.
Exactly, yeah.
Which I feel like is what people want. Like, the flashback where, like, he's dying in Nick's arms and he tells his story. And it's
yeah.
like, no, that would be really bad.
Yeah, like, that would be utterly meaningless. It would add nothing to what this... story is thematically developing, because this story is not about like the soldiers on both sides of the conflict and like that complex political situation. It is just about soldiers in general. And like the what's important about the space setting is that by removing it from like our grounded reality, it allows the story to take a more sort of like general grand perspective on things that like if this game was set in World War II, the story would not have the same effect because it would feel too specific if it was attached to an individual conflict, and it would be too easy if this was like set during Vietnam that like you would look at that and like, well, that was a, that's the thing that happened in Vietnam, and it would be easy for people to say like that happened in Vietnam, it doesn't happen now. So not everyone would have that reaction, but like a historical setting leaves that reaction for people of being able to say like, no, that's a, like that's what like soldiers, that's what happened to soldiers in the 70s, that's what happened to soldiers in the 40s, that's what happened to soldiers at the turn of the century. Like, but it's like by setting it in space, it's like, no, this is what happens. This is what war is like. This is what happens when, like, the technology of war advances. Like, it allows to generalize the issues that the story discusses, and it's what's important about the space setting. It's one of the things that frustrates me about the people that, like, dismiss this game because it's like, oh, it's Call of Duty in space. It's like, there is a version of that game that is, like, terrible because all they did was say, like, oh, space is exotic and cool, so let's set it there. This is like, no, space gives us an opportunity to tell a much more powerful story than we would if we tried to tell this same story on Earth. And, like,
yes,
they use the setting in the right way.
And, of course, there's all the gameplay stuff associated with that,
yes, yeah,
which we'll get to, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, so you have this story, you know, for... It's a pretty directly told story. You talk about the economy. If you were to just ignore the side missions and stuff, you could beat this pretty quickly, I think.
Yeah, yeah, probably like 4 to 5 hours if you did no side missions.
Although I think the side missions are very important. And I even got to a point where I was about to get into the final mission, and I probably put, you know, 7 hours in so far, and I was thinking, man, I would definitely play the 30-hour version of this game.
Uh-huh,
where, like, maybe they built the ship out a little more, and there were more variety to the side missions, and it was like a Mass Effect-style thing, except the main gameplay mechanic was first-person shooter instead of sort of a third-person kind of thing. And I think that could actually totally work.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And because that there is enough richness to this that that would work. Ultimately, I think the story works just fine in the length it is.
And I think, like, the story they have to tell works better because it is, like, quick and to the point. And like I said earlier, like, in the spoiler-free section, there's something really refreshing about this kind of game just telling a quick, effective story and not being, like, a big bloated one. Because usually, like, if you want that in a video game, you have to go to, like, Inside or Gone Home. You don't go to a Call of Duty for that, you know?
Right. But I do think those side missions are important, in part because they don't just ignore the characters during them. It's not like everyone's silent during those side missions.
Yeah.
I think actual important character work happens, the way some unlock after particular missions. Like, there's that one after you do the thing on Titan, which is that super dramatic, amazing cutscene at the end where Nick gets ejected, he tells the ship to jump, Ethan the robot saves him, which is an incredible scene. And after that, you open up this side mission back in the Titan area, and the way kind of characters talk throughout that is an interesting, like, that feels like what you're supposed to play after that mission rather than just jumping onto the next main story mission. And I think just having, you know, those extra side missions where it feels like, one, the gameplay mechanics get to develop completely, which they wouldn't get to do if you just had those seven main missions. But two is also, like, you get to do a little more of the day in the life of these people. That it's not just this one mission. They also have these other things to go and clean up.
It gives it so it feels like it is a war and not like a single battle.
Exactly. So I think all of that is very smart. And the way they're laid out, that you can play them in different orders, but it also feels like however you play it, it's, like, right for the story. There's no moment of, like, clear break where it's like, I don't think they'd be doing this right now.
Yeah.
It's like, no, this seems important, you know?
Yeah, and also, like, the side missions have so much gameplay variety in them that, like, other than, you know, the space fighter missions are sort of what they are, like, then they're a nice sort of, like, change of pace, but the actual, like, full side missions are, you know, they are really different. Like, some of them are full-on stealth missions. Like, one has, like, almost a Hitman-y thing to it of, like, where you take the disguise and you have to sneak around and, like, and then after, like, your disguise gets blown, the mission changes. Because also, like, this is one of the best things about the game is the way that the missions evolve as you play them and, like, sort of, like, what you're trying to achieve and how you can achieve it changes as the mission changes. But then, yeah, like, there's some that, like, are sniper missions where you start, like, floating in space with your sniper and have to get to a ship. Like, others are you start in a dogfight and then you get into a ship and stuff like that. And, like, the variety in the side missions is really awesome. And it was one of my favorite parts of just playing the game was, like, I spent a whole day just, like, going through all the side missions and just, like, because they are tight, like, 30-minute missions that all feel really distinct and different.
Yeah, my favorite mission in the whole game, just from a gameplay standpoint, might be that stealth one, because it is so satisfying if you get it right. And, you know, I had killed almost... There's this big room, and you have to try to take out as many people as you can stealthily.
Right, yeah.
Because otherwise, the main guy will kill the hostages. And so you try to take out everyone you can, and then I got to this point where I had almost taken out everyone, and then I was about to take out someone with a sniper rifle, and I missed someone, and they noticed me. And so I'm like, fuck, we're going full bore now. And it's just going in and, like, trying to save the hostages, and I managed to pull it off. But it was like, it felt right. Like, there was some randomness to it where you can't do it as cleanly as you would in maybe a traditional stealth game. So there's just things like that where I was constantly surprised by the gameplay mechanics and the thoughtfulness of the level design that, you know, I think of Call of Duty still in the back of my head as running down a hallway and shooting an infinite amount of enemies, and there is pretty much none of that in this game.
Yeah.
It is, there is so much variety to everything you do, it is impossible to get bored in the 10 hours you spend with this.
Yeah, because also, like, one of the things that helps with the variety, we kind of touched on earlier, is, like, the variety of equipment that you are given. That I love, the weapons in this game are so really, really smart, because they all have, like, or not all of them, but a lot of them have alternate firing modes that are, like, alternate firing modes. So it's like when you have your sniper rifle, like, you can switch it out for it to be like a basic assault rifle. Or I think one of my favorite ones is the assault rifle that just, you like, it's an assault rifle that has like a foregrip on it, and then when you go to your alternate mode, you just pop out the foregrip and it's just two submachine guns.
Yep.
That's a really good one. There's a submachine gun that's also a shotgun. Like, there's a lot of that kind of stuff where, like, the weapons feel sort of futuristic, but not like crazy, crazy futuristic, other than like some of the special like particle guns you get that are a little like, I mean, that's, I feel like a lot of that stuff's like for the fun of it. But yeah. But yeah, like, the core, like, weapons you get in the game feel pretty grounded, but they also are exotic enough that there's a lot of gameplay variety in how you can use these different weapons to approach different situations. And then there's the eraser pistol that just disintegrates people and is really awesome. But then the equipment in the game also, where you have like your drone hacking thing, you have the shield, all those, like, I feel like in most Call of Duty campaigns, they give you stuff like Claymore Mines and C4 and shit like that, but you never use it because it's never needed. In this, I felt like...
I used it constantly.
Yeah, I used it constantly. And I also, I don't know what difficulty you played it on, but I played it on the heroic equivalent.
I played it on Hardened.
It's a pretty difficult game at that difficulty. And so it does require you to make use of that shit. And like the shield and like the foam cover and all that stuff, like, is actually really... And the grenades, like, in the different grenade types, like, all of them are really useful, and you need to use them to get through some of the harder combat.
And the levels are so clearly built around those different mechanics, and like, you have to think strategically. I think the equipment is so good because it is so tied into the level design. Like, sometimes, as you say, that drone hacking, I the first time I saw that, I was like, I love this game.
Yeah.
Because what you do is you, on your side computer, you hack into a robot, like, across the room. Now you're controlling that robot, so you can go around and just kill enemies with it, or you can do a self-detonation and just take out a bunch. And the way they even, and they do this a lot in the final hours, where they bring that back, and that's specifically how they kill Salen Koch, which is a great scene. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
But, like, so that was amazing. My favorite thing in the game was the shield, because you can upgrade the shield to a point where it will show you your enemies.
Yeah.
So I would constantly have my shield. I'd bring it up to see the enemies, and I'd kind of move around with that because then I couldn't get hit. And then I'd come back down. And sometimes you can also use the shield to go do a bash and kill someone. It is awesome, but also, like, so useful.
Yeah.
And it feels like it has such utility. As you say, all the grenade types, the actual drone you get that will help you attack people.
Yeah, that's really good.
All of them.
And I like that you, like, in a lot of those longer missions, you know, you find different caches of the other, like, grenade types and stuff like that you can find that to switch up your loadout while you're playing a mission so you're not stuck into what you picked.
Yeah, maybe you need frags here, but now you need shocks because you're fighting robots, or you want some of those, the guys that will, the searchers who will go out and find people.
Yeah, your drones are really good.
Because maybe you're in a big room and you need to get some, just clear out the ranks a little bit.
Then plus, like, if you, like, I love that doing the side missions unlocks things and you get things of that will, like, upgrade some of your equipment so that it'll make the frags more powerful, or, like, the seeker drones. Like, I think at default, the seeker drone just sort of goes at the closest enemy, and then you can get an unlock and upgrade for it that allows you to sort of, like, specify the enemy that you want it to go for. So there's a sense of, like, very light progression throughout the campaign that feels like it is by far the most successful version of what Call of Duty has been trying to do for a while, which is take the progression mechanics of the multiplayer and get them to work with the single player. And usually that's just like a, oh, like, you're giving me the option to pick a loadout, but it's just like, I'm just going to use the default loadout. Here, it's like you're actually progressing throughout the game and, like, unlocking useful things. And it's all that stuff, like the equipment and all that and the level design, that makes it so that, going back to something I said on podcast like a couple of weeks ago talking about Titanfall 2, it's the thing that, like, I've seen people praising the campaign Titanfall 2 so much, and I think it is a very good campaign, but I don't think there has been a lot of discussion about, like, how the actual combat in Titanfall 2's campaign is not that interesting, and it is the kind of stuff that Infinite Warfare gives you, these tools that allow those rooms to feel like little combat puzzles of, like, I'm pinned down here, and I have my frag grenades, I have this shield, I have this drone hacking thing, I've got my sniper rifle, I've got a shotgun, how am I going to take out all these guys that are coming at me? And, like, you have all that equipment, and you have to use them creatively to sort of, like, plan out how you're going to approach this room. And Titanfall 2, like, the combat in that is fun, but it's just, like, very much like, oh, I'm just gonna, like, hop around and shoot people in the head, and that's, like, all this game can really provide me, because I also play Titanfall 2 on the same relative difficulty mode as Infinite Warfare. And, like, it's that kind of stuff that I feel like is kind of going unappreciated in the design of this game, of, like, it is, like, the core fundamental level design and combat and counter design is really strong.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. I mean, there's so many individual levels and moments that I remember intensely, in the way I remember things from Halo 1,
yeah,
and things from the new Doom, and other just, like, classic first-person shooter campaigns that I put at the top of that genre. This goes right up there with them in terms of, you know, just, I like the term, like, combat puzzle. That's what it feels like, where it is taxing your mind as much as it is your reflexes. It's not just run down the corridor and shoot and shoot and shoot and
yeah,
shoot. Yeah. It is superior in a gameplay sense, just, yeah. And the actual ship combat stuff too.
Yeah.
Good God, I love that.
That's like the most spectacular stuff I've done in a video game, like, maybe ever, is, like, the way they handled that ship combat, and especially, like, how you can, like, transition in and out of the ship combat,
yes,
in some levels. This, like, just, like, the fucking, just, like, starting a level in your, like, big frigate thing, and just, like, 3, 2, 1, and, like, launching out of the ship, and then, like, right into this hail of, like, a lot of it reminded me of, like, the beginning of Episode 3 of Star Wars, where it's just, yeah, like, that big space fight over Coruscant, and it's just, like, chaos where you're weaving around all these ships, and missiles are flying everywhere, and you're just trying to get a beat on, like, okay, there's, like, the enemy ace pilot, like, I'm gonna go take out that dude. Another thing that made it feel like Gundam to me is, like, how they talk about these aces,
yes,
that are in the sky, and, like, these, like the best of the best that you have to go take out, and it is that sense of, like, having to maneuver these incredibly chaotic battlefields that's, like, you know, I think the actual, like, combat in the space fighter sections is, like, if you're looking for something really in-depth, it's fairly light, but there's something about that is, I think, perfect for the gameplay as this change of pace of just being, like, let's fucking do this, like, let's just fly around all this shit and shoot, and it's just chaos.
Yeah, but even if it's kind of light, like, I think it's the best version of that I have ever seen.
Yeah.
And it's something that I feel like a lot of games sometimes toy with, but maybe for a level or two. Like, what I kept thinking back to was the Long Night of Solace mission in Halo Reach.
It's very similar.
Which is phenomenal.
Yeah.
But that's not the full game. It's a one-off thing. This is it's something that comes back throughout the full game, and how I think they cracked it and the secret to it is it's so intuitive to play.
Yeah.
Like, you don't even need to be really taught the controls for it. However you think you need to steer that ship, it just does it.
Yeah.
And however you think you need to lock on and fire missiles, that's just how it's going to work. It feels, like, really direct and intuitive, and just, like, you are in control of that ship and doing crazy shit, and it is so fun and puts you into that combat zone just with such insane depth, you know? Yeah.
It is, like... It's an overused buzzword for video games, but, like, immersive is the way I think, yes, of it. Of just, like, the cockpit and, like, the way, like, he like, maneuvers the controls as you maneuver your controller and, like, manipulates all these joysticks and stuff. And just, I love it anytime I'm playing a game that allows you to fly a ship in space and I can fly really fast in one direction and then spin around and keep on moving that direction and shoot behind me, because that's what you need to be able to do, and this game does that.
So it does, like, that.
Feels awesome.
Perfectly. I played the majority of this game with my PlayStation headphones on, and it was the perfect way to play this.
The sound design is insane.
It's insane, and it is. I feel like it should be played with headphones because so much of it is, like, stuff in your ears.
Yeah.
And I love how they do it.
And it's just, like, crazy radio chatter and, like, things just pinging off of your windshield and stuff.
It is. It's great. And it's also, like, because Nick Reyes in those sections would be wearing some kind of headset like that,
yeah,
whether it's a helmet or something. So all of it, just, I love it. I quipped on Twitter, but I'm really only half joking. The people who made this should totally make the next Star Fox game.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Because this is kind, not to that level of, like, violence, but with, like, that level of clarity of control and precision of control, that's what that series is at its best.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I would want from that someday. It's, yeah, I mean, honestly, I never thought I would say this about a Call of Duty game, but if you love Star Fox, Infinite Warfare is the game for you.
Yeah, exactly. The same thing with, like, if you really like Halo. Like, yeah. There's a lot in Infinite Warfare for you to love.
Yeah, so that's gameplay stuff. Do you want to get back? So the story, I feel like, in the beginning, it's just kind of establishing the characters, and you go on some missions, and it's really just the team kind of building. And I thought one of the most special things was just those little cutscenes you'll get in between missions, or even on missions, where characters just talk.
Yeah.
And it's not exposition. It's not that they are there to deliver the next piece of the story. Like, one of the best scenes is just, it's Nick and the staff sergeant, played by David Harewood from Supergirl. He plays Martian Manhunter.
Yeah, so. I saw that when I was looking up a lot of the actors on this game, because that's another thing, is like, it is Naughty Dog level of like incorporating actor performances into a game. And like, I loved that dude so much, and then I saw that he was Martian Manhunter. It's like another one of those pieces of like, I really need to get around to watching Supergirl at some point. Yeah,
he's great. He doesn't have that exact accent.
Yeah, which I just is assumed
great,
that.
But yeah, it's great. Anyway, there's a scene where they're just talking, kind of just about being soldiers. Mm-hmm. And the subtle clarity of that writing and how much it does without drawing any attention to itself to make you feel like those characters are real three-dimensional people, you have to tie it to Naughty Dog. It is Naughty Dog-level writing. And this game, I was very surprised in the credits. It's a one-person writing staff, Brian Bloom, who also voices Nick Reyes. And it's a great vocal performance. But what a double hitter for that guy. Maybe critics aren't noticing it, but I am sure the industry is noticing that is a hell of a script.
Yeah.
Just the dialogue throughout, and assuming he also wrote stuff in the credits. I mean, I think the writing in this game is superior.
Yeah, like, it, both in, like, the structural elements of the plotting is superior, and, like, the thematic storytelling, like we're talking about with the memorials, and there's a lot of other that kind of stuff in the structural plotting of the game. But then also, like you said, the actual dialogue in the small character moments, which is stuff like, we're going to be talking about Rogue One after this, that's like, I feel like a lot of big Hollywood movies are forgetting how important those little character dialogue moments are to stitching the things in your movie together to make it feel impactful, because that's the kind of stuff that is missing from Rogue One in a lot of places.
Right,
This has it all over the place and finds time for it, even while being a really tight shooter campaign.
Yeah, Infinite Warfare slows down and lets the characters talk like they are people, and it's the weirdest, my biggest complaint with Rogue One is it should be longer. It's too short for what it's trying to do, and it's missing moments that are really important, and Infinite Warfare takes the time, whether it's on a mission or in a cutscene, to just have characters talk, and that makes a world of difference. Like, you know, it's also funny, like, both Rogue One and Infinite Warfare have, like, a robot character, and I think the robot character is one of the best parts of both, but in this one, like, Ethan the robot comes across as a character so profoundly, in part because so much of his dialogue and character building is just casual moments, where, like, you see, there is no one moment where the staff sergeant comes around to liking Ethan. It's just that Ethan kind of proves himself in a mission, and then he's like, let's take Ethan along, and then there's that scene in the ship where they're like, you know what, we got Ethan the robot along with us, and he's one of us, what are the Marines say, and then Ethan like does the motto, and then everyone goes oorah, and it's just like things like that just make a world of difference, and building up to, you know, Ethan is one of the people who has a letter in the credits, and man, they do such great work with a character who should feel so familiar.
I feel like we should just do a deep dive on Ethan, because to me he is like the linchpin of the story of this game. Like, so much of what this game is doing revolves around him, and they use him so well, both as just like a character and as his role in the story thematically. So Ethan he's the robot guy, and it is like, at first I kind of, when they introduced him, I was kind of rolling my eyes because it felt like, this is ridiculous. Like I'm fine with like the unmanned drone kind of robot things, but he's, you know, full AI. He talks like a person. He like walks around like a person. He just looks, he doesn't look particularly human, because they don't go for like a realistic human looking robot thing. Like, he's got like a big like cylinder head with a fucking like light bulb on the end and shit. But it is like, you slowly realize over the course of the game like what they are doing with him, of like they are building him up, that it's not just that he is like the most human, which is a very sort of like generic kind of like sci-fi thing to do with the robot, like, oh, the robot is the most human of all of us because he's the one who has to learn how to love or whatever.
He's not Data from Star Trek.
Exactly. Yeah, but he what they end up doing is, I feel like they turn him into that, at least for me, and I suspect a lot of people, like, Ethan feels like exactly a friend I have, or like, I haven't seen in a long time, but I knew when I was a kid and knew him in high school, who was like, his family was like a military family, and he was like all about the Marines and all that stuff, and you know, he like wore like camo pants and stuff like that, and he went hunting, because we're in Colorado, a lot of people hunt, and like, he was that guy, and like, his family was from the South, and he had a slight Southern accent. It was like, Ethan is him. Like, Ethan is, I feel like everyone knows someone like that, that has that kind of family history. It is that kind of person who's like also like really funny, incredibly sociable, but like is also like serious, because like they really have this patriotism to them. They have this passion that like they're going to join, like he did join the military. Like, they're those kinds of people. And I feel like Ethan is that. Like, Ethan is this like 18-year-old kid from Alabama who like kind of like has a bit of something to prove, but like is like, but isn't like in your face about it, and he's respectful to the people he needs to be respectful about, and when those people are not around, he's the funniest guy in the room. And like, that's the person that Ethan is, and it feels like there's something so natural about him being that kind of like stereotypical military brat kind of kid. And but then like, as the story goes on, I feel like you realize kind of the darker part of like what his role in the story is, that ultimately culminates in like what you have to do to Ethan, is that like he serves as a way for the story to be able to kind of almost like literalize the metaphor of like what commanding officers do to their soldiers, which is you tell people to go die. And so at the end of this game, the way that Ethan dies is you use the drone hacking thing, which is a really smart way to take a gameplay mechanic and bring it into your story in like a really serious way. And you could literally embody and control Ethan and take him down into the reactor where he self-destructs himself. And it's like,
no, you press the button.
Yes, you press the button. Like, you kill him. You make him sacrifice himself. You literally control him to do that, which is already what you are doing the whole game. Like, you are doing that when the staff sergeant dies. Like, that is what you're doing. Like, when anyone dies in this game, you're playing Nick Reyes. You are the commanding officer. Every death is partially your responsibility, because you are ordering all these people to go doing what they are doing and telling them to go into the face of death and sacrifice themselves for the greater good, or for the cause, for the mission, whatever you believe in. And like, that was one of those things that just hit me so hard about what this game is doing, is that like, they make Ethan the most likable character by also making him like I said, he's this like kind of almost stereotypical military brat kind of guy. And then he is also the person that has like, in some ways, he has the most literal sacrifice of like, you just have to go sacrifice him. Like, you have to literally do it to him by controlling him physically. And like, that is a level of symbolic storytelling that like, I would not expect the vast majority of Hollywood movies to ever even like think of doing. Like, the fact that a fucking Call of Duty game did it blows me away every time I think about like how this game came to be. That like, symbolism is like, and not even just symbolism, like gameplay symbolism, like a ludic symbolism of like, you are doing it, you committing a gameplay action that has a symbolic meaning to the themes of the story. Like, that's something you almost never see in any video game. It's like, it's in fucking Call of Duty. Like, I keep in my head, I go back to that tweet. It is stupid how good the storytelling of this game is, because there is no reasonable world in which this game should have come out this way, you know? Like, it's insane.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that ties back to the character of Nick Reyes and some of the smart structural things in this, and that he doesn't start the game in a commanding role.
Exactly,
And he's thrust into that. And one of the inciting events in this story is that big space battle where the Retribution, the ship you eventually command, the captain of that ship, who you never meet, kind of takes it in on sort of a suicide run against one of the Mars ships, one of the SDF ships, and in so doing does kind of save the day. Like, he allows them to survive to fight another day, but sacrifices himself and a lot of his men. And Nick takes what initially both you and him think is the correct position of saying, that was crazy, the role of a commanding officer is to protect his people, why on earth would this guy do that? Yeah. And then through the rest of that game, he has to kind of question what was sort of a holier-than-thou attitude, but not an unreasonable one. Like, it's not about Nick, like, being proven wrong. It's that
you have to face up to the harsh realities of, like, the world you live in and, like, what the military actually is.
Yeah, and he has no way to know those things until he's in those shoes. And I think that's another just literal piece of symbolism, is the idea that you know, criticize some of these people and these decisions all you want, but literally we don't know what those decisions are until you experience it.
Yeah, and it's something where the game does so many smart things of, like, you have the one woman who's sort of, like, in charge of the flight deck, who you have some conversations with over the course of the game, and you find out that, like, oh, she was in this position where she could have been a captain, but she decided not to be and didn't take that promotion, and she, like, got off of the field and went down to work in engineering, and, like, that, and, like, she has a sacrifice later in the story. And I love that, like, small... Again, it's like all these great small character moments, but over the course of the game, you sort of like seeing that in her and like realizing the perspective she has and like what she like can give you as Nick Reyes, like this different perspective of like, no, you are not actually really taking this seriously. Like, you don't really understand, like, because we haven't been in the full shit yet, and you don't really know what is going to be asked of you when you get there. And like, I have seen that before, and I decided like I was not a strong enough person to go into that. Yeah. It's like, I just want to make sure that you know what it is. I think her role in the story is really good. And another part of like kind of like a much smaller version of the memorial thing that I love is this kind of the cyclical thing. Is so at the start of the game, like, the commanding officer of that ship dies. You are the old, like, the highest ranking person on board, so Nick Reyes is just sort of thrust up to command of this ship, and that's kind of the situation of how that happens, and you're just promoted by the admiral to be the commander of the ship. And like near the end of the game, after the staff sergeant dies, who is the first like major like named character casualty in the game, you are then put in that exact same position of where there is another Marine who is not really prepared to be in that role of commanding the Marine squad, and you have to promote him. And, like, you, as Nick Reyes, as the commanding officer, like, have to play the role of the admiral and, like, just, like, repeat the cycle of, like, well, you're the best we've got. Like, we don't have anyone else, so you just have to be this person now. Like, and you have to now make the decisions that Omar used to make, and, like, you're probably going to command, like, all these people who are your friends. They're probably going to all die, and it's going to be half your fault now because, like, this is the only position I'm in to do that. And, like, the way that that story just does that, just throws that out there of, like, this, like, really tiny little, like, smart cycle in the middle of that story that sort of, like, bring things around full circle and, like, gets you on, like, the top swing now to then ultimately sacrifice yourself and let it then, like, Salter then is presumably going to be in this a similar position later. And, like, again, it's, like, really small, subtle things that they do over the course of the story that's, like, it's incredible to me, like, how smart and tight the script is and how complex of a thematic argument they're able to build about the role of a commanding officer in the military and the sacrifices and, like, the duty that they have. Like, it's nuts how much they get across in an 8-hour campaign.
And how, apart from just those structural things, that in the moment to moment, how much they convey of that,
yeah,
on an emotional standpoint, like, the final hours of this game are overwhelming.
Yeah.
Where you get to the point where, you know, Nick makes that bad call where he says, pull up, to because they're about to crash into the big... the center of the SDF fleet.
Yeah.
And Nick is going to be taking the what's it called? The big ship. I forget what it's called.
I played this game like a month and a half ago. Yeah.
Sailing Pasha's ship.
Yeah.
And he's going to take it in, but then the Retribution gets hit and is coming down. He tells Nick to pull up. Ultimately, it's a really bad call because then they have to go through and try this whole thing again because in trying to save the Retribution, he kind of dooms them all in a different way. But after that, you're trying to literally climb this tower, which I also feel like is very symbolic to where, yeah, we're getting. And you get to the end of that and... there comes a point where, after everything that's happened, and Nick just realizes this is a fucking suicide mission, and the way he quietly accepts that, and, like, the physical and vocal performance in that scene where they're all in the room together, and Salter is asking him, how are you going to get back? And he says, none of us are getting back.
Yeah.
And that is, like, it is such a gut punch, especially because it's not the end of the game. You have to then go just fucking play it. Like, yeah, you have been told, this is not going to end well. There's not a God who's going to come save us. And that's what you're expected to play. This game, I mean, very specifically, it is not like the nuke the character moment for Modern Warfare. It is not a surprise
when
Nick Reyes dies. You are playing the last level of this game as a fucking suicide mission, and it puts other things like that to shame. Like, it almost made me rethink my thoughts on some of the things at the end of Mass Effect 2. Right. That Mass Effect 2 goes through the game calling that the suicide mission, and the whole point is it's not. You save everyone and you get out alive. Infinite Warfare makes you play a literal suicide mission. where the only character who lives is someone you never played as,
yeah,
you know, Salter. And I think that's so fascinating and profound in how they do that, and just specifically some of the ways in that last hour, like you talked about the moment where Ethan dies, but also the way Nick is, you know, calling on Salter, fire on my position, fire on my position, and it happens, and then it just lets the scene play out until the moment he dies.
Yeah.
And you are floating through space, you almost get back on the ship, you don't, your helmet cracks, and it's there through all of it. It holds you there and makes you watch and experience all of it. And that's a level of boldness that is just crazy to me.
Yeah. And it is like that whole sequence after you crash on Mars, and particularly like you gather all your people together again to go off on that last mission. And there's something about like, it makes you realize like how memorable the characters in this game are. Like even the small ones, like the dude, I think his name is Griff, that like the armory guy that helps you, like, and like the fucking dropship pilots and stuff, of like the people that you just kind of see over the course of the game, that like they're not given a huge amount of screen time, but like, they just come up casually. They come up in the side missions, which is one of the things that builds your relationship with them. So that, like, by the time you're at the end of that game and you're, like, marshaling all your people together and you can walk around that camp and kind of talk to people, it's like, you have this real bond with even the small characters, so that as you're going along the mission and you have to have people be like, okay, like, you have to stay here and hold this position or we're going to get fucked and you're going to die. Like, you're just going to die. Like, we're on Mars. Like, we're not getting reinforcements. Like, I'm just telling you to stay here and hold this elevator down until all of you are dead. And that's, like, the only thing we can do. And, like, just having to do that over the course of that mission, and then, like, having, like, the named characters die right in front of you, and then ultimately Nick Reyes being like, okay, like, this is our last thing. Like, we go take that thing out, and we're all probably going to almost undoubtedly die. Like, I'm going to have you fire on my position. I'm going to, like, literally control Ethan and have him self-destruct and blow up the thing. Like, this is it for us.
And it also matters. Like, this is part of this. This is why I don't quite understand people's criticisms of, like, the SDF side of things. Within the world of the game they've established, they establish it well enough to make you understand why those sacrifices matter.
Yeah.
It's not a case of them saying war is meaningless, because that's kind of a trite point at some point to make that, you know, argument. And they aren't doing that. And you can question sort of the larger structure of all of this, which I think is implicit in that.
Yeah.
But the point of, like, they have to do this in their position, and that's what's so powerful about it, is that they are making a very real difference in things, but that cost is so, so horrible, and so makes you think about those things, you know, because there's a reason why they have to stack the odds so high in this game, because that's the only way you can have this payoff feel like it means something.
Yeah.
Dramatically. So, yeah.
So then we come to, I think, what is maybe, other than the Ethan thing, like the biggest genius stroke of the storytelling in this game, which is the ending credits.
Oh, yeah. The best credits in a video game ever.
I mean,
or the smartest.
Yeah. So, like, in the credits, they have you, like, while the credits are playing, they basically just bring up 8 button prompts, your D-pad and your 4 face buttons, and all of them have a character portrait next to them of the different, some of, like, the big main characters in the game. Some of them are sort of, like, the smaller, like, you know, the helmsman of the Retribution and stuff like that. And as you press on those buttons, they read letters that they wrote to their family or whoever's, like, most important to them in the case of their death. And it's just those actors reading these letters about, like, their family. And you find out, like, oh, this character was estranged from their father. Like, this character had children, like, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know how you did it, but, like, as soon as I realized what it was, like, I worked my way down so that Salter was my... I don't remember if Salter's on there because he doesn't die. I think she... Is she on there? It's like...
I don't think so, because I think, isn't the woman who is your kind of the engineer sergeant, she's on there.
Yeah, she's on there. I don't remember who I had, like, be my second last one, but I had Ethan be my last one.
Because Ethan was my last one.
Because I just felt like as soon as I realized, like, what these all were, I was like, well, that has to be the last one. And having that one be when you get there and, like, because you go through, like, all this gauntlet of all these other characters talking about their family, their children, their father, their best friend, like their lover, whoever, and, like, all these people in their lives that are the most important people in their lives, and telling them, like, apologizing for mistakes they've made, or like, saying sorry for not being able to come home for Christmas, or, like, whatever it is. And then you go all the way to, like, Ethan is your last one, and his letter is addressed to you, because you're the only, like, you and, like, the staff sergeant are kind of the only people he had in his whole life. Like, they're... his best friend and his brother, and, like, because that's the life he had. It's like this, like, he was alive for probably, like, 3 or 4 years or something, like, or conscious for, like, that long. And, like, he's a robot. He doesn't have anything else important to him, but like he still is this sapient like creature, and he has that relationship with you, and like that was such an insane gut punch. Like especially having to remember like, you know, like having to control Ethan and make him self-destruct that like you very literally kill him. It's like unbelievable, like emotional impact over the course of those credits.
And the specific content of those letters.
Yeah,
that
very well
written.
They are
beautifully written. They feel like they are all in a very different voice. They feel like they have different levels of just, there's a story to each of them. There is a real impact to each of them. It is, obviously the point is making you realize every single one of those deaths, because they give you the number, it's like 700.
Yeah.
Every one of those people is a person, every one of them has a story, and every single one of them will have another life destroyed because of this. And that is really conveying the cost in a way that I've never seen a game do.
Yeah.
And I love that Ethan's letter, especially if you save it for last, what's interesting about it is it's about his experience personally, where he says, as horrible as this was the best day of my life.
Yeah.
And recognizing that, and again, I like your comparison to Ethan as, you know, he is kind of, he's a robot, but he's an archetype of actual people in the world
yeah.
who have very real experiences that we shouldn't ignore, and that it's not all sad for that kind of person necessarily.
Sure, yeah.
Because the meaning they take in that means something, you know?
Yeah.
And I like that that is acknowledged through that character, and that is why that is such a poignant gut punch to it.
Yeah.
But man, the flood of emotions at the end of this game is crazy.
Yeah.
It is something that no Call of Duty game should be capable of pulling off.
Again, it's stupid. It's stupid how good it is.
It's stupid how good it is. And it's just surprising for video games in general, even if you get past Call of Duty. Just first-person shooters are not a genre we are used to having this kind of storytelling or emotional impact in, and it fucking nails it.
Yeah. It's something where Patrick Klepek from Waypoint, on Waypoint Radio, like this is like weeks ago, like this is around when the game came out, and I remember listening to their podcast, and I generally agree with him on a lot of his opinions, but he was talking about this story, and like I could not more profoundly disagree with this criticism, and I have seen this echoed other places of like, oh, like it's a shame that they had all this backstory for these characters, and it's a shame you only find out when they die, and they should have had it like more stuff built into like you on the ship finding out about like Omar's like family or something. And it's like that is not. They are like the credits thing is not some sort of like clever get around to it. It's like, oh, we found this way to put character development into a video game story because we couldn't figure out where else to put it. It's like, no, if they wanted those things to be conversations in the game, they could have been conversations in the game. Like there are plenty of places where you could have conveyed that information, that they have built mechanics and systems that and opportunities to have that be conveyed. It is very obviously clearly intentional that you understand these people as soldiers because that is you are coworkers, effectively. You are like really extreme versions of coworkers. And so you understand their role as like them doing their job. While you are playing as Nick Reyes, it is only once they're all dead and you as the sort of player, the person experiencing the story, is thrust out of that viewpoint that you are then provided the information that gives you that perspective of like, oh, right, they're not just soldiers. Like, you are playing that whole game, like, seeing them just being, like, the best people at what they do at doing their job, and it's only then that you are given the actual, the proper perspective of, like, they're more than just that. Like, they have people they love, they have their family, they have friends, they have all these things, they have these whole personal lives that you have no reason to have a window into that part. You're playing as their boss. Like, with you, like, how many people under your employment do you know, like, everything about their family situation? Like, that's not the kind of relationship those characters have. And it feels like that's one of the things that is so impactful about it, is that you get that perspective once the story is over and you get that realization of, like, right, these are, like, full people with full lives.
You talked about people, like, going down the checklist. It is something that frustrates me with movies, TV, and games these days, is, and especially with, I think, the rise of a certain kind of internet discussion and hot takes and things like that, is people, it's all hegemony. It's all, everything has to be the same. There is the good story, and it is a checklist, and if you don't fill that, fuck you, you didn't get it right. That's not how it works.
Yeah.
There are different scenarios for different kinds of storytelling, and I think one of those hegemonies I hate is that there is one kind of character development.
Yeah.
And this game, I think, has a very specific kind of character development that is brilliant, which is that it is you seeing these people, A, from a very particular perspective, and B, those characters acting from a very specific perspective. And so often storytelling breaks those perspectives to fulfill kind of a false idol of what this is.
Yeah, to try to make a like well-rounded character.
And that's not what this story is doing. And I think the characters are very well-rounded for the perspective they exist within. And this story only has meaning if it is told from a particular perspective.
Yeah, because like if like you're saying, like if people want the stories to be told in that very like hegemonist way of like every character needs to be quote-unquote well-rounded, everyone needs to have their tragic backstory or whatever, their father abused them, they, you know, they like left their family when they're young, they're born an orphan, like whatever, they need that, and that has to be conveyed during the story, like in a very explicit fashion, in some sort of like intimate moment. Like if you wanted that, going back to Star Wars, like that would be then in episode 4, you would get Darth Vader talking about like, oh, I was this young boy who was a slave on Tatooine like you, Luke, but I was taken by the Jedi and then trained, but then I was betrayed by my master and my arms were cut off and I was set on fire on lava and it really sucked and it hurt a lot. And then now I became this badass dude. Like, all that stuff of like, I mean, not all those literal experiences are certainly not baked into that character necessarily in episode 4, but it is definitely in episode 5 and especially episode 6, like, well before you find out any of that stuff about Darth Vader in episode 5, like it is implied that there is something tragic behind him, that he has something more before they reveal him being your father. Like there's you don't need to have those moments at every single turn and to have that be like the thing that like is what is all the story. Like if you have that backstory for the character, it can be baked in and just sort of like something that makes the character feel alive, especially through the performance. But it doesn't need to be made explicit to the player or the reader or whoever, like, every single moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's transition into Rogue One.
Yes.
Because I think it's interesting how, in comparison with Infinite Warfare, I think it does certain things similarly well and certain things very poorly.
Yeah.
You know, I will say up front, one of the things... So, spoilers for Rogue One from this point on. If you have not seen Rogue One, I guess you don't live on the planet Earth. I don't know. I think everyone's seen this movie. I don't know. Anyway, so spoilers for Rogue One. I think the ending of this film is the strongest part in terms of the climax, the last 45 minutes or something. And I think I am impressed that this is a Hollywood studio movie called with Star Wars in the title that had the balls to just kill every single person in the movie at the end.
Yeah.
That is, I don't want to undersell that is not a thing that these kind of movies do. And that impresses me that they had the guts to go for that.
And it is the right ending, like, hypothetically, for the story they're trying to tell.
And I think thematically, it is doing something kind of similar to Infinite Warfare. And this ties into the things I like about Rogue One and how I think Gareth Edwards uses iconography, is that it's taking something we know very intimately, which is Episode 4 and the destruction of the Death Star and kind of the kickoff to the entire universe of Star Wars narratively, and saying, you know, we just know it as the Luke Skywalker and Han and Leia went and did all this themselves. But that entire last 45 minutes, which I do think is really well done, and I want to praise it, is this handoff of all these little sacrifices that happen consecutively, and some of which hit me very hard. Like, I think the way they do the Donnie Yen sequence at the end is very smart, where it's this little thing that no one will ever know that guy's name. No one will ever know what he did. His act of heroism is to walk across a field of bullets and pull a, you know, trigger or something, the switch. And if he doesn't do that, then none of that other stuff happens. And it's, you know, so that's a little moment like that. You have big moments like what happens to Jin and Diego Luna's character. And you have little moments like, you know, the guys on the ship when Darth Vader comes in and goes crazy. And that one guy who gets his hand through and passes that off. Down to that. I think there's a really smart progression of all those sacrifices from the bottom to the top that have to happen. And the way it works in some of that iconography is why that matters to us. It is really playing on, that's the smart side of this as a prequel, is playing off, you have to know the New Hope story because that's what gives this meaning, and that's the non-fan servicey things to me that I think work very powerfully. The difference, and I do have to go back to this, is so our main character is Jyn Erso.
Yes.
The first time we see her as played by Felicity Jones, so not the little girl character, but the first time we really see the character we have in this movie, she is being rescued by the Alliance and sent on the mission.
Yeah.
We have no sense of who she was beforehand. We have no sense of what her life has been.
Yeah, we have no idea why and I still have no idea why she was in Imperial prison, because you find out later that she has no interest in fighting the Imperials. And that was like, when she said that, I was like, wait, then why the fuck, why were you in prison? I just assumed that you were fighting Imperials or something, and then that's why you got thrown in prison. I felt that was like a weird detail. It sort of contradicted the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, so all we get is, she's sent to the place where Mon Mothma is.
Yeah.
And one guy reads off basically her resume, and then says, you know, you're going to go on this mission. And so by the time she meets Diego Luna and the story of the movie starts, basically we open the film with the second act, and there is no first act where we meet the characters and get to know them. I think it works okay for someone like Diego Luna or some of the other characters where they are defined. This is just their setting. They are rebels. That's fine if you meet them in that sense, because you can develop them that way. But the whole point is that Jin is doing something new and that she has this redemptive arc in the film. But there is no start to that. There is no foundation to that. Yeah. And I think seeing her as a little girl watching her dad get taken away, it's a fine scene, but it doesn't, there's no, we go from point A to B with nothing of the journey there.
Yeah, like, and that scene does way more to establish her dad as a character than it does her. Like,
right.
It's just like a weird, there's, I think it's a lot of the problem with this movie is like, there's a lot of weird priorities in different scenes of like, where it's like, that opening is a pretty substantial scene of her as a kid and her dad and her mom getting killed and her dad getting kidnapped. But it's like, that scene is so much more about his dad and the villain, or her dad and the villain, and not really about her. Like, because they cut as soon as Saw Gerrera finds her, and like, presumably something important happened after that, that is like, helps to establish her as a character, but they cut away.
It is very strange, and actually, comparing this to his Godzilla movie, it has the exact same problem.
But, where, like, kind of almost flipped. Where Godzilla's problem was that it spent too much time with the characters, and then when the action started with Godzilla, it cut away. This is like...
No, what I was going to say.
Oh, okay.
What I was going to say is with the Bryan Cranston character.
Oh, okay.
Where early on, the father is kind of established as the main character, and it's the same thing here. Like, Galen early on gets... And the plot revolves around him way more than Jin, but then he is killed at a point in the movie where it feels like his story is still starting. And so I feel like Mads Mikkelsen not being in the second half of this movie is bizarre for how they treat him early on. The same way I feel like the way they kill Bryan Cranston in Godzilla is a little bizarre for the story they're trying to tell.
Yeah, yeah. The thing I was going to say was, we'll get more into this when we get to like the action climax, is like, this movie has a weird thing where it feels like they get to a scene where a character conversation, like character development is about to happen, and then they cut to, like, action, or they cut to something else, and it's, like, the same thing that Gareth Edwards did in the Godzilla movie, only in that was, like, oh, Godzilla's about to start fighting, and then we cut back to the characters kind of doing nothing, and it's, like, why would you do that? And it's, like, now it feels like he overcorrected in a weird way or something. There's something where it's, like, I feel like he likes this trick of, like, something significant about to happening, and then kind of, like, pulling the rug out from under the audience's feet and like leaving you to be like, oh, I could like sort of fill in the gaps with your imagination, which for some stuff could like in some of the scenes in Godzilla worked okay. Here it feels like, no, like we needed to see like this conversation. We needed to see like something
happen.
Give me an
example.
I mean there of like cutting away when like Saw Gerrera is about to get her, like is like something important needed to happen there. And like I didn't necessarily feel that in the moment. I felt that later when it was like, we don't know anything about this character, and that's where you could have done that.
I say there's no first act. There is technically a three-act structure to this thing, like very literally, because the first act is them on Saw Gerrera's planet. The second is them on the planet where Galen is and dies. And the third act is the end of the movie. And I think the first act, this thing's on this planet Jeddah, is narratively such a mess. I don't even know. Like, Saw Gerrera isn't a character. He makes no sense. I don't know why the rebels are sending them there. Apparently, Diego Luna knew where Galen was the whole time anyway, and that is never explained. It's an enormous plot hole.
I think the pilot tells him that off screen, I feel like, is the implication.
That's not conveyed to the audience.
It's not conveyed to the audience very well at all. No, that was me, and that might actually be completely wrong, because I had the same thought when they got to that planet, and I was like, how the fuck did they get there? And I'm pretty sure that they imply vaguely that pilot tells him. That introduces the pilot is a whole weird bag of worms of like, what the fuck was with Saw Gerrera and like the weird like psychic alien thing that was supposed to break his mind? That I assumed that was going to be like, oh, we need to get this information out of the pilot, but he's gone insane from being like mind fucked by this alien. And then that never, literally never comes up again. And he seems kind of loopy in the first scene. And then he's like, I'm the pilot. And then he's totally normal. It's like, okay.
Yeah, Saw Gerrera is a character out of a different movie who it feels like is the center of that movie, whatever he's in. But in this movie, he's just... I think Forrest Whitaker, I don't know what direction he was given.
Yeah, he really overacts in a movie that no one else is overacting in.
And he's a great actor. Yeah. It's Forrest Whitaker. I like the look of the character and some of that stuff, and I think he's interesting on a lore level, and I know he has ties to the Clone Wars and stuff.
Like, they actually could have used that really well for thematic purposes, because he fights along Anakin to like help rebel against the Confederacy. That it's like that, like obviously, like you would have to like find a clever way to sort of get that kind of exposition out there. But it would be a really effective parallel, especially since like. Other than we know who Darth Vader is because we know Star Wars, Darth Vader has no reason being in this movie anywhere. That's like, they could have, you could cut him out and like that would not affect any of the actual main plot and character stuff in this movie, which is kind of weird to me.
I mean, I like his scenes.
I like his scenes. I wish that they made him more like kind of relevant to like the immediacy of the plot.
I mean, I understand why he's in the universe in here, but I agree. Like, there's not like a thematic reason heavily for Darth Vader to be there.
Yeah.
Maybe in that last scene, but I get it.
Yeah, yeah. But, like, but anyways, like, I thought, like, they, for whatever reason, they make this weird decision to have Forrest Whitaker be technically playing a character that is from the Clone Wars cartoon in, like, a two-part episode. That's a really good two episodes. And it's like, and it did feel like, oh, there is, you could have that be here because he also, he kind of looks like Darth Vader. They make a clear reference to, like, he has this respirator thing that makes a very similar Vader-y kind of noise. Like, And he used to fight alongside Anakin and presumably has no idea that now the very people he's fighting against are being led by the dude who taught him basically how to be a rebel. Like, there is, like, really effective dramatic material there built, baked into the backstory of that character that, like, they in no way bring up. And it feels completely pointless that that character is... Like, he feels like, oh, we have this character, let's just name him this from that Clone Wars cartoon to be a cheeky reference because this movie is full of cheeky references.
Yeah, well... But, like, my bigger problem is just the whole reason they get Jyn Erso on this mission is that she was raised by Saw Gerrera, but we get no real sense of what their relationship was. There's a brief, you know, interlude with them, but, like, by the time he's kicked out of the movie, nothing he's done makes sense. Why he chooses to stay and die doesn't make sense. What his relationship with Jyn was, I have no idea. I don't know how that made her the woman she is. None of that is conveyed clearly. And then there's other just stuff that just makes very little sense. Like, some of the stuff with Galen, I think, is interesting on a narrative level. But then you have, he sends out this, you know, hologram with the pilot that's like his message.
Yeah.
He specifically says at the beginning of the message, I have no idea if my daughter is alive, and he would have no idea if this would ever get to her, but the entire message is specifically to Jyn.
Yeah.
And there's things like that that, like, it's a well-made scene. I think Felicity Jones and Mads Mikkelsen act the hell out of it.
Yeah.
But I kind of came away with it thinking, the story does not make sense so far. No, and I've liked moments of this. Like, there is some really good stuff in that section where, like, there's some funny stuff with the robot. There's some funny interplay with Diego Luna and Felicity Jones. And then you meet Donnie Yen in that part. Yeah. And he's great. And he lays a fucking just beat down on those stormtroopers. And it's awesome.
Yeah.
But I came out of that whole section of the movie thinking, all right, I'm kind of worried about this movie at this point because some of it's good. But, boy, I don't quite understand what the story is or why, like... It's like they can't quite decide if they want Jyn to be the MacGuffin of this movie or kind of a character disconnected from everything, and they try to have it both ways, and you can't do that.
Yeah.
Like, one of the things I liked about Force Awakens is people can theorize all they want about whether or not Rey is a Skywalker, blah, 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 but, like, just in the diegesis of that movie, Rey is someone who lives on this planet and is kind of sucked into it in the same way Luke was, and it doesn't feel like... She is this giant MacGuffin to the plot. I feel like they know what they want that character to be, and it works. Here, it's like they're trying to both be that and then have her be the linchpin of this whole universe because she's tied to Galen Erso and all this stuff. And it really, I don't think you can have that both ways.
No, yeah, like, and a lot of sort of, like, some of that stuff with, like, the message and her forgetting to, like, bring the message with her and, like, kind of, like, her character's role in the story and a lot of the characters, like, it just... A lot of this movie feels like it just sort of the plot stuff comes together by accident in a really weird way of just this, like, weird contrivances of, like, down to, like, even the name of the movie feels so insanely arbitrary when they get to the scene of, like, we need to come up with a call sign, Rogue One?
Oh, I think that's a good scene.
It just felt like a, like... Like, okay, like, I didn't even really understand why they needed to, like... Like, the mechanics of, like, what was that literally happening there, of, like, who he was talking to and stuff, was just like, what is happening in the scene? Like, why are we doing this right now? It felt like a weird way to sort of shove the title into the movie, and, like, that didn't need to be there. Like, they could have just been, like... Because also, they just decide to go on this mission on their own, and, like, that's a whole other discussion. But, like, I thought, like, some of those sequences in the movie, it felt like there's no real reason for this to be this way. It just kind of is by accident.
I guess, I mean, that makes total thematic sense to me, because that's the group of people who are going off to have this forgotten sacrifice, and it's also a name that just comes out of the blue. Like, there's a purpose for that being by random, because their whole existence there is sort of random, and it's about the randomness of these different sacrifices that lead to the big thing at the end. That's an
idea. I guess. I didn't really feel it, because also, it just it doesn't feel totally random, because, like, all these people do, like, while they are thrown in together, like, they all, like, very intentionally... whether you see them intentionally make the decision or not, presumably Donnie Yen has some conversation with someone at some point behind the scenes of this movie and was like, yeah, I'm really dedicated to this cause. I'm going to go help these people. Instead of him being in the background, just being like, kind of like, I'm going to follow her path. It's like, okay. Like it feels like there are, like, these characters have at that end intentionally come together to try to do something together. Like, it doesn't feel random at that point for them.
Well, yeah, they make the choice very specifically, but the different circumstances is about chance and some of these things.
Okay.
It's fine. But where were we with this?
I don't know.
There's the whole part on Jedha. I mean, and again, like, some of the production values here, the first firing of the Death Star and the specific images that are conjured there, unbelievable. I mean,
yeah.
I don't want to downplay that. There's, like, the way it's like that big nuclear cloud that comes up above the planet, and the way that's framed with, like, the Death Star in the background. There are some images like that that are just fantastic and making you see the Death Star from literally the reverse angle. Because
yeah.
The Death Star is a macro-level thing in A New Hope, and this is all about the micro-level stuff. And I think when the movie focuses on that, I think it's very effective. And I think, if anything, it needed to get into the minutiae more sometimes and not kind of get lost in some of the larger storytelling, because that whole idea of being on the ground when the Death Star fires, that's something we very literally don't see, and for a good purpose in A New Hope.
Yeah.
And that's the reason to tell this story. And I think at its best, those moments are at least aesthetically very powerful.
Yeah.
I was a little distracted in that whole Jedha sequence because I don't understand the story yet.
Yeah.
Or why these are the characters we're following. And, you know, it's easy to, I think, overlook some of that, because I do think the performances are very good, and I think you can tell Felicity Jones and Diego Luna in particular are trying very hard to conjure a character. And there are moments where I could set aside for at least an instant, like, oh, right, there is no character that the script is giving Felicity Jones to play,
yeah,
but she is putting a lot of that in there herself. And there are moments where I think that works very effectively, and moments where the script is working against her so hard, it's kind of hard to watch.
Yeah,
for
me, the only person I could do that with, or the only two people, was Donnie Yen and Zhang Wen. I could always forget that guy's name. But, like, I thought, like, they had such a strong presence, and they do kind of have enough of a character. They at least have, like, their... quirky enough to sort of, like, pop a little bit, that I kind of felt
that
with
their characters. I mean, I think, for, you know, this is an ensemble movie where you have a lot of different characters, and, you know, though those are not the main characters they're supporting, I think as the supporting characters they are, I think they come across very strongly, and I think there's a good, you know, thematic tie together to how they die at the end of the movie that has been seeded throughout. Like, that to me is the best bit of screenwriting in the movie, is those
probably
two characters.
But there are so many holes in, like, they just desperately need those characters to have, like, some fucking conversation with the main characters that, like, establishes why they are still here. Because it just feels like they just keep on going along with stuff, and nobody has asked them, like, do you want to do this? Should we drop you off somewhere? Like, why are you still with... Like there's... They just, like, are there. And it was one of the most insane bits of the screenwriting to me. It was like... how have you forgotten to justify why these characters are here? Because it's like, literally, they are on the one planet that gets almost destroyed by the Death Star, and they leave together, and then the guy gets his mission to go to this other planet to get the father, because I can't remember any fucking characters' names, so do not ask me to, because they don't have characters. But, so, like, they're trying to all go to that planet, and, like, from that point on, like, they just never bring up why Donnie Yen and Zhang Wen's characters are still with them. Like, and, like, their planet that they were on was just destroyed, basically. The village they lived in was destroyed. And, like, but they are both, like, guardians of this temple that has been destroyed. And they're just with them now. And it never comes up. And it's so bizarre to me.
And it didn't bother me, but I see where you're coming from.
Okay.
All right. So, anyway, yeah. So, I mean, I will say, on a larger level, I do think, you know, ideally the strength of this movie is in its ensemble, in its ideal form, where you have those, like, six characters together. And why the movie has impact is you watch them die in different ways at the end and all that. And no, I don't think any character in particular is developed enough for that to have the full impact it needs. I think it has impact because I think it's very well made at the end, and there's a lot of good stuff near the end in terms of staging and how they tie off certain character arcs. But yes, there's a lot of moments where I'm like, okay, either the movie needed to be longer, or you need to do stuff like cut Saw Gerrera, figure out what you're doing with Jyn Erso, and then slow down and let these characters breathe a little bit, because again, ideally, that feels like that's what the ideal version of this movie is where you really get to know that ensemble in a way where, you know, their actions are more than just pieces on a chessboard. And for those first two acts, at least, it's a lot of chessboard kind of maneuvers that don't feel like, you know, organic character things. Because, like, just down to, you know, the Diego Luna character does come around to, right, I shouldn't kill Galen. Why is there even a discussion for him? Like, as soon as he hears what Jyn has told him, there's a, you know, he should be conveying that to his command, not just blindly following whatever that order is.
Yeah.
You know, and I kind of like the idea that part of the movie is trying to show how the Rebel Alliance also has its problems, and these characters, you know, that is an organization in and of itself that has bad things to it in terms of bureaucracy, but most of that is conveyed by the Rebels being really stupid. And that's a problem, where, like, Diego Luna has to realize, it's not that I'm being given a bad order, I'm being given a stupid order.
Yeah, and like, it just felt so forced of, like, the bad Rebel general who's like, you're just gonna shoot the shit out of that dude, and we're not telling anyone else we work with that you're just going to shoot this guy that, like, has valuable intel, that is this, like, brilliant scientist, that is making this giant super weapon, that, like, if we captured him, we would find out a lot of really important shit, whether you know he's working with you or not at that point. Like, it felt like such a, like, why would you do that? Like, that's just stupid. That's insanely, from, like, a tactical perspective, that is insanely stupid fucking thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, that whole middle part of the movie where they're on that second, the blue planet, whatever it was, and they're there to kind of meet up with slash take out Galen. Again, there's some okay moments in there for me. That is the weakest part of the movie, because all of it is predicated on the Rebels just being dumb.
Yeah.
And also, like, Galen dies because it feels like the movie wants him to die there.
Yeah, there's another thing that feels like it just happens completely by accident. That's like, oh no, we crash in, our comm thing is out, so it's like, the Rebel commander's like, oh, let's just bomb it then. It's like,
why? Yeah.
Yeah, like, are you not going to do something? Like, you're not going to, like, reconnaissance it? You're not going to, like, find out if there's anything there, really, if your people are still there and alive, like, what they have found out? You're just going to go bomb this fucking random building on this one fucking planet.
Yeah.
Like,
I also have to say, you know, the larger narrative justification for all this is that Galen Erso was taken by the Krennic guy, whatever his name is, Ben Mendelsohn, and is made to make the Death Star. Okay, I can buy that. That happens, whatever.
Sure, yeah.
But then his whole justification for why he kept working on it and never, like, killed himself or something is he felt like, well, if I didn't do it, someone else would. But if I do it, I can put this one thing in there that will allow them to, rebels to eventually destroy it.
Before that, he did it because he was afraid that the guy would find his daughter who was missing, which I thought that was, like, a little bit of a weak justification of, like, my daughter, nobody knows where my daughter is, but he might be able to find my daughter if he really wants to, if I stopped working on it. As if that dude wouldn't already be scouring the, like, universe to find this guy's daughter to be able to blackmail him just in case, you know?
Yeah. So none of his justifications for building this Death Star make all that much sense. But it's another thing where I can see, this feels like the first draft of a script. Like, I can see where you could clean that up and make it clean. Because I like the whole idea of, you know, you have that silly thing in A New Hope where there's that one ventilation shaft, and giving it a real character reason, I think, is a nice idea.
Yeah, I thought that was by far the smartest thing they did with this being a prequel to Episode 4 of, like, just sort of, like, feeling like it's like, okay, yeah, like, that gives some sort of, like, actual extra meaning to the end of A New Hope to me in a way that, like, feels a little bit more impactful, at least at that point in the movie.
Absolutely, and I think I think it's okay as it's done, where you have this relationship between Galen and Jyn, and that kind of drives it, and that's the whole reason why the Death Star could be destroyed was because of this guy's love for his daughter. But again, I think as it's literally presented, it feels like the first draft version of that idea.
Yeah, like, it's a cool idea, but they hadn't found a good, like, way to motivate it in the script yet.
Yeah, and again, also having him die as soon as she finds him, I don't need those kinds of stories anymore.
No,
especially when I think that scene itself is one of the limper scenes in the movie in terms of staging. Like,
I felt like even as stupid as it was, they had that they were trying to build up this tension between the male lead protagonist and the female lead protagonist, and so like and of him having the orders to kill her dad, and like that just felt like that kind of like all that narrative tension that they were like very limply trying to build just sort of like farted away. It was like, why would you use this here? Like, why was that even built up? Because it's like this at where it is in the script, like it has no like dramatic thrust anymore. Like, you should have done it later if you were going to do it, or you should have just not done it at all.
It really does feel like the two halves of this movie are very separate to me, because yeah. Once you get past that point where Galen dies, they get back on the ship and they return to Yavin 4, to me the movie kind of clicks into place and the rest of it works much better and feels more polished, but it feels like the more polished second half to a different movie, because like the narrative changes, their justifications for things changes, character motivations, like where Jin is headed and what she is doing, like she has a big turnover at that point that again is like executed well in terms of acting and things like that, but because of what we saw from the first half of the movie, it's like,
well,
that doesn't feel like an organic progression of that character. It really does feel like the movie changes in the middle to kind of a different version of this film.
I mean, she literally goes from one scene yelling at male lead protagonist about, like, you fuckers killed my dad, like, and having not wanted to do anything to deal with the Empire shit at all, and not wanting to be a rebel. Like, she went from, like, talking to Saw Gerrera, is like, oh, all you have to do is not look up, which I thought that was a good line in a weird scene. But, like,
that's a very good line, yeah.
Yeah, like, she had, like, that character well established, and she is mad at the Rebel Alliance because they just fucking killed her dad. And then in the very next scene she is in, she's giving this rousing speech to the rebels about how we need to go do all this shit. And she repeats male lead protagonist line about, like, all rebellions need hope or fucking whatever was it, all that shit. Like, there's, like, a whole, like, series of scenes missing here about, like, her doing some soul-searching that, like, also feels like that's where, like, the Donnie Yen character could have come in, because he's this blind spiritual monk guy or something. Like,
yeah, yeah.
There's stuff, there's, like, really, really significant narrative connective tissue that is just completely missing in this movie that, like, killed it for me in so many ways.
No, and I get that, and I don't think it killed it for me as much, but I do think, you know, the last half, like from when they're back on Yavin 4 to the end, that all feels like the right version of itself, but following something different. That's like the best way I can describe it.
Sure.
Because, again, I totally see what arc they're trying to give Jin Erso, and I like it as an ideal arc, because you have this woman who, I like that whole idea of she is so kind of broken that it's this, you just don't look up. Like, you have to ignore it, because that's how bad this whole situation is, and I'm just trying to live my life. And going from that point to someone who's willing to die for all this, it's an archetype for a reason. That kind of story works, but the script does not put in that legwork, because it kind of goes back and forth on her, and so much of the first half of this movie is really just different narrative chess moves, trying to get pieces into place, without doing the actual character building for it.
And it's really frustrating, because it feels like you don't need to do any of those chess moves. Like, that's one of those things of it feeling like the first draft of a script is like, I have not done a lot of screenwriting or anything, but it kind of reminds me of like when you write a really long essay or something and then you look at it again and you're like, oh, I'm just going to cut out like my first three paragraphs here, and then my fourth paragraph is actually my introductory paragraph because that's when I figured out what I wanted to be. That's like this movie of like, they did their first two acts and like they're like different and weird and unfocused, and then you get to your third act and it's like, this is the movie I was trying to make. But then instead of going back and making that, like, I'm not necessarily making that the beginning of the movie, but like making it sort of thematically or like conceptually more like the beginning of the movie and then like developing it from there, is just like, they just went with what they had. Is like,
because
really weird
to me, like, you know, I think in the moment the opening to this film with Galen and that planet is effective, like it draws you in.
When you don't know what the rest of the movie is going to be, it's a good opening scene.
To me, the way I would open this movie, like, I would change very little about the last 45 minutes.
Sure.
Like, I like that essay thing, because I do feel like that's where they got to, like, clicking in, and then I would revise the beginning. But the way I would open this movie is, first off, I would start it with Jin and then build out from there. And you would have her on some planet doing some kind of, you know, see what her life is that would get her in a position where she would be in prison or something. Probably have her run into the Diego Luna character. Have some kind of relationship that builds there. Have them brought back to the rebels. And at some point it is revealed she is the daughter of Galen Erso. And then this means something to them. But not starting with just that is what she is, because I think that severely limits what kind of character development you can do.
Sure, yeah.
And then once you know that, maybe, you know, things have already started to change because of this character development. Then you go off on this mission to kind of try to find him. Maybe you do a flashback to something like that or something to kind of give that information. But you have to have it centered and then build out from there. And the movie builds very haphazardly because it starts with this macro level view on Galen and the Death Star and all this. And then it expects Jyn to kind of be this focal point when she is at no point established in the actual grammar of the film as the focal point.
Yeah.
And that's a problem in that first hour.
And for me, and I guess this is like where I imagine like a lot of people the difference becomes is that for me, the fact that that stuff is so poorly done and the characters do not feel well established at all and the plot is so meandering, it made to me like honestly the action climax of this movie I found pretty boring for most of it.
And I've heard that from people and it's weird. I disagree on the level of I didn't feel that, but I don't disagree in what you're saying of why that is the case.
Yeah.
You know,
and I have specific reasons that when we get into it, we can get into it. But it was, I think, fundamentally, I just did not care about the characters. I liked some of the actors, but, like, I just didn't care about the characters almost at all. Like, almost, like, I kind of liked the Donnie Yen character and the Zhang Wen character. I kind of liked the robot, but, like, I like them on, like, the, like, oh, they're, like, kind of funny and, like, the surface level of those characters.
Yeah.
And at no point do those characters ever become anything more, you know?
No, and you know, I go back and forth. The other way you could do this movie is, I don't know if this had to be a movie with a central protagonist.
Sure,
I think you could have told the version of this movie that is a broader scale ensemble thing, and it is more, and because that's also kind of the thematic mode in which they're operating, is about the way this rebellion works because of all the other people that are involved. And I think you could do that kind of thing where it's almost more of a band of brothers, you know, Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg, Saving Private Ryan kind of thing, where it's about the kind of the scope and the tapestry, and less these just small particular characters.
Yeah, or it's like for me, it's one of the other weird like conversations I have about this movie is I felt like the movie that I watched was not at all what I thought the movie was going to be based on the trailers, and that like I have no idea how they came to the conclusion that like this was what the plot of this movie was going to be, because to me like everything about those trailers said to me like this is a movie about like this group of rebels that's like the like weird people that like they assemble together, this like strong team of people that like have to go in and infiltrate the Death Star or some Imperial facility to get the Death Star plans, and it is like, if not in, like, its narrative, like, tropes and character archetypes and stuff, at least in, like, the general structure, like, the movie demands to be a heist movie based on the objective they have of what they are trying to do, and in no way did they make anything even resembling a heist movie, even in, like, anything of the structure. And, like, there's something weird about, I don't understand how this is what the plot of this movie really is, like, all this shit with her dad and, like going to all these planets with Saw Gerrera and all that stuff. It feels like all that's irrelevant to what you're really trying to do, which is, like, you're trying to give a really complicated reason for them to go find the fucking plans for the Death Star, and the only reason you need to find the plans of the Death Star is they made the Death Star, we need to find out how to blow it up. How do you find out how to blow it up? Let's find out how they made it. Like, that's all the justification they needed. And it's, like, really weird.
It is. I mean, again, when we talk about where it clicks into place, for me, is when the character motivations click into place. And the character motivations in the end are very clear.
Yeah.
We have to find the plans for the Death Star. This is going to be dangerous. This is possibly crazy. And that's why we kind of have to go in as a small team. But, again, as you say, that's the kind of motivations that you should get in the first act, not the third.
Mm-hmm.
And to get to those motivations so late, I totally understand how that's a problem. For whatever reason, the last half of this movie worked for me. I think so much of it is, I do think the filmmaking is exceptional on a visual and aesthetic level and all of that. And I think a lot of how it's put together in that last half especially is just crazy superior. And there's some amazing stuff that goes on there. And I don't want to downplay that, but I do understand why, you know, movies have to be built on more than that.
Yeah.
I get that. So, you know, I'm going to take a break. We'll get into that in a minute.
Okay.
Let's take a break to talk about a different issue with this movie.
Okay.
Because I actually want to, this is part of a larger point I need to make about the end of this movie.
All right.
Grand Moff Tarkin is in this movie.
Not just Grand Moff Tarkin, because there's a lot of ways you can have the character Grand Moff Tarkin from Episode 4 in a movie. But of course, that character was played by distinguished, beloved British character actor Peter Cushing, who died in 1994. You know, the star of the film and screen. He was in all the Hammer horror movies, like Van Helsing and stuff. He is Doctor Who and Doctor Who and the Daleks and the other Doctor Who movie they made, the weird fucking 60s Doctor Who movies. Great, great actor. Huge, like, even though he has a relatively small role in episode 4, always made a huge impression on me. Like, yes. he has such a presence. He has such a distinct, like, face and way of carrying himself. But of course, he died in 1994, but the character has such a perfect reason to be in the movie because he's the Death Star guy. He's the guy who says, you may file when ready.
This is kind of, it's the weird, I think the way Grand Moff Tarkin is written in this is perfect.
Sure,
like, in terms of where he is, where he appears, and thematically, I really like the whole idea that you have this character who the Death Star was his, like, pet idea, and that's how ruthless the Empire is that Grand Moff Tarkin doesn't give a shit. He's not only going to take the Death Star from that guy, he's going to kill him with the Death Star.
Yeah.
That's actually a great image at the end of the movie where he says, fire when ready, and it fires, and Crescent kind of looks up and gets killed by it.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. In fact, I would dare say Grand Moff Tarkin might be the best written character in the whole movie in terms of his place structurally in the plot.
It's very well done, but the way they chose to do it is through a CGI reconstruction of Peter Cushing's likeness, which is one of the... No, it is the most disrespectful use of special effects I can imagine.
I could not fucking believe it. Because I hadn't heard about this before the movie came out.
I heard about this 2 years ago as a rumor. And it was rumored online. And I think my conclusion and a lot of people's conclusion was that's crazy. They would never do it.
Yeah, so I had never even, like, the thought had never, literally never occurred to me that that was something that you would ever do in any movie, let alone this movie. And then they have, and there's a little, like, bit of, like, background to this. The Grand Moff Tarkin has been a character in Star Wars Clone Wars and Star Wars Rebels, because it makes sense. And he is, in that show, or in those two shows, he's voiced by the guy who voices him in this.
Okay.
And the guy does a really great Peter Cushing voice.
And if you're doing it in just animation, it's fine.
Yeah, obviously. Like, it's, the character is the character. They make him look like Peter Cushing, but it's a cartoon. Like, it's a cartoon version of him. So, yeah, like, that's not an issue. But it is something weird where it's like I had perspective on, like, Grand Moff Tarkin having been used in, like, Star Wars material recently with, like, a Peter Cushing-like thing. But it was, you have the scene where they introduce him, and at first I thought, I was like, oh, this is actually, like, really tastefully well done, because it makes so much sense. Like, this character kind of, if you want to have strong connective tissue to A New Hope, like, he needs to be there. Like, it kind of wouldn't make sense if he wasn't there. And I thought the way they did it of, like, oh, he's standing in front of this window and from behind, and you see him, and he looks like the silhouette of the guy, and you can kind of see in the reflection in the window a little bit of his face, and it kind of looks like Peter Cushing. And then it's the I could recognize it as the voice from the guy on the shows. I was like, oh.
That's tasteful.
That's a tasteful, like, really clever, well-done way of doing that. And it actually gives the character this presence and weight in the scene that is both respectful to... Peter Cushing and makes the character feel impactful and, like, kind of like almost mythical in a way that works for Grand Moff Tarkin for me a lot. And then the camera starts slowly zooming in on him and slowly zooming in on him while he's talking, and then he turns around and you have a close up of him right up in the camera talking, and it's a fucking, like, plasticky ass CGI Peter Cushing, and it is the most, as you said, disrespectful thing I've ever seen in a movie in terms of, like, using something of a deceased actor. And it is also the most distracting, just devastating effect I think I've ever seen in a movie. I could not pay attention to anything that was being said in those scenes on, like, a, like, deeper level than just, like, what literally the words meant, because I was just staring in horror at what was on screen, both in terms of, like, the effect I think is fucking awful. And I think the effect is fucking awful, you know, like, in kind of every meaning.
Peter Cushing has been dead for 22 years.
Yeah.
He cannot sign off on someone using his likeness. And just because he was in a movie 40 years ago, it is not okay to do that.
Yeah.
I just, morally, it is wrong. Just because an actor was in a movie a long time ago does not give you free rein because you own the IP to mine his likeness for that reason. It's bad. And then, yes, it's just distract. Take out all morality. It's distracting. And this has to go to a larger conversation we have to have with Hollywood.
Yeah.
Recasting is okay.
Yeah.
You can recast. Stop being so afraid of it. It's a weird thing. Like, the only example of a clean recast I can think of in the 21st century is Dumbledore in Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Where Richard Harris...
And that's, like, early 21st century.
Yeah. Richard Harris died, and they said, okay, I mean, it's really sad, But we got Michael Gambon. They did it. They didn't do anything clever where, like, it's like, I had to change my appearance or something. They just, he's just Dumbledore. And you go on with it, and does anyone talk about how that's weird? No, we just accepted it. Dumbledore looked different. Whatever, we can accept it. But, like, even when people do recast sometimes, like, people just can't get their heads around that. Like, in the third Matrix movie, the actress played the Oracle died in between filming of 2 and 3. So they got a different actress to play her in the third movie. The way to do that is to just have her there and not comment on it. And it's like, hi, Oracle. And then you're like, okay, that's the Oracle. Yeah. We get that. And instead, they went into this big metaphysical mumbo-jumbo about how she had changed. It's one of the worst things in a very bad movie.
Yeah.
But I think, like, the 21st century TV and movies is littered with this, where we're just unwilling to recast for whatever reason. I guess the other one would be Iron Man 2 when they did Don Cheadle and not comment on it. But that's so rare these days. Uh-huh.
And that's also a weird one just because that's like a contract thing. That wasn't like Terrence Howard did not pass away. They just didn't want to work with him anymore.
Yeah, and, you know, to me, recasting is okay. The part is the part and the actor is the actor. There are certain scenarios, obviously, where, like, they shouldn't do the next Avengers with someone other than Robert Downey Jr. because that's such a big presence.
Yeah.
But there are other cases where, like, it's just if we understand recasting. Like, there are a lot of recast parts in Rogue One.
Yeah.
That is not the original Mon Mothma.
No.
That is not the original General from the End of A New Hope. Things like that. But you know what? We accept it because the character is bigger than the actor. But now we're at this point, and I think it's a weird thing. Furious 7, the 7th Fast and Furious, was kind of the turning point where people realized, oh, we can recreate characters through CGI. Because that movie did a pretty good job finishing Paul Walker's role through the use of stand-ins and CGI. And that was a very respectful thing to do because they were trying to finish his last performance and say goodbye to that character and let that character live on without him. And so that's like, they did that for, I think, a very good reason. But what scares me is it might have opened the floodgates for things like Rogue One to just decide, hey, fuck it, this beloved actor died. We don't need him anymore. We get a voice alike and some CGI and we're golden. But they're not. They've bought into the myth that CGI looks as good as real things.
Which it does not.
And it's extra...
Oh my God.
It's extra weird in Rogue One where one of the things I love about Rogue One is pretty much every ship you see is a model and it's clearly a model. Like, they are not doing mostly CGI ships here. Like, there's that great scene at the end where two Star Destroyers crash into each other, and those are model-ass models breaking, and it's great. But that, contrasted with CGI Peter Cushing, is the most distracting thing in the world, and I don't think anyone would be distracted if you just found some cool actor
who looks kind of like Peter Cushing, kind of like Peter Cushing.
And that would be kind of fun to have a new actor do their own spin on Grand Moff Tarkin.
Yeah, and then you can reasonably reuse that character in other movies if you want to with this new actor playing him. And it's like, I don't think there is a person on the fucking planet that would not accept you recasting a role from a movie that came out in the fucking 70s. You know, like... Of course you're going to recast him. Like, that's what we expect, and it's what you want, really. And it's something where...
It would be like if they made The Godfather 4 today, and they still had Al Pacino, but then they had Marlon Brando reconstructed for a flashback.
Yeah, and that's what I'm thinking of, like, this is also a much larger discussion that we're not necessarily equipped to have, but I want to just sort of, like, broach the subject of, like, if you are an actor working in Hollywood and you see this, I would be fucking terrified, because guess what Hollywood has? Hollywood has access to, like, over 100 years of movie stars that a lot of them are dead, and they do not have the ability to sort of protect their own likenesses. They have their estates, and, like, that is a very different sort of, like, moral thing, is getting the permission from an estate than getting the permission from an actual person. And so now, if someone fucking wants it, they can have Orson Welles be in their movie, and you just get, like, the guy who did the voice from Pinky and the Brain that sounds like Orson Welles to do the voice, and you just have a fake Orson Welles on screen, and all you need to do is pay your CG animators fucking dirt cheap, and you have your, like, voice actor dude that does the impression that you're not paying them that much, and you have a stand-in on set, and that's all you need. You don't need to pay, like, fucking $50 million for Robert Downey Jr. or whatever. You don't need actual, like, modern-day movie stars. You just need some animators and a stand-in and enough money to pay off someone's likeness.
I mean, I would really hope that when this movie premiered, there were people in the audience of leadership in SAG who got on the phone immediately after and were like, we need to figure this out.
Because this is some fucked up shit that we never thought about before that was even possible.
But I mean, that's what SAG is for. It's a union to stop this kind of shit happening. And there have been, I do think this will probably be resolved that way, because there have been cases like this. One of the famous ones is in Back to the Future 2. They used clips of George McFly from the first movie
yeah.
without giving compensation to the actor, Crispin Glover.
Yeah.
And so Crispin Glover sued. He won, and it became a SAG contract thing, which is where if you use someone's likeness, you have to compensate in some way. So obviously this would be covered by that on some level. The problem is Peter Cushing is dead, and we have CGI technology, so clearly there's an extra legal wrinkle to this now. Yeah. And I really hope someone at SAG is on the phones trying to figure this out with lawyers of, like, that is what unions are for, is to protect actors from that. Because, as you say, it goes both ways. One, I wouldn't want to be an actor thinking, oh, God, after I'm dead, I hope they don't make me do, like, a crazy porno or something.
Yeah.
But also, it's like, I don't want to lose work to CGI Orson Welles.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, like, yeah, it's just bad. And it's just, it's such a distracting thing, because, as you say, I think if Grand Moff Tarkin was just played by a recast actor, those would be some of the best scenes in the movie.
Uh-huh.
Easily.
Yeah.
And I think all that works very intelligently on a scripting level. The way they decided to execute it is awful. And the other negative effect it had for me is I'm okay with the last shot of Leia the way they did that.
Sure.
In a vacuum.
Yeah, if that was the only time it happened, I would be kind of okay with it too.
Because I think it's kind of, it makes sense that you would see her.
Yeah.
Carrie Fisher is still alive.
Yes.
She can sign off on that. And it's one shot, so even if it's not the best CGI in the world, whatever, it's one shot, and it's not that distracting. But because you've spent the whole movie watching CGI Grand Moff Tarkin, the last beat of the movie is something you kind of have to roll your eyes at, and that's not good.
Yeah.
Because again, I think on a scripting level, I like that as the last beat of the movie.
Yeah. Especially because they literally do, like, the exact same thing as they do with the introduction to Tarkin, where it's like, the door slides open and you see Leia standing there, and it's like, you can tell it's Leia, because it looks exactly like Leia from the beginning of A New Hope. She's wearing the same clothes, like, she's the right body proportions, like, you can see her hair poking out, and it's like, princess, we have the plans, or whatever they say. And it's like, that's kind of all you really needed. Or then, like, maybe you have her say hope or something, but you never see her face. But it's like, she is... You can tell who the character is, but instead they can't fucking resist having her turn around and closing up on her face and say, and her going, hope. It's like, why would you do that? Like, she looks like a creepy plastic person. She doesn't look real. Like, especially when we are looking at real people for the whole fucking movie. No CGI aliens do not have, like, a huge presence in the movie. The alien that has the most screen time is the fucking Admiral Akbar-looking motherfucker, the Mon Calamari, and that's a practical effect.
Yeah.
So it's like...
I mean, even the robot is a guy in a suit.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, the robot is a way more, reasonable and believable character on screen than these quote-unquote human characters you have, like, on the Death Star and shit.
It's so bizarre, because I think one of the things we can all unambiguously say these new Star Wars movies are doing well is resisting CGI. Like,
yeah.
Like, they are going for practical sets and location work and model work, and I love that. I think that is so commendable. But then, for some reason, you bring this CGI person bullshit in, and it's like, that runs so counter to your overall production methodology for this movie. That's kind of the biggest problem, just on a pure practical level.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's weird.
That was really weird.
Thank God Darth Vader is just a guy in a suit.
Yeah, that and that James Earl Jones is alive and well, and he can do the voice.
Yeah, so, let's talk about the two Darth Vader scenes really quick.
Okay, sure.
While we're on that topic, because they're much less distracting.
Yeah, it's just Darth Vader.
You know, I think they're both good. I have not had the pleasure of seeing Star Wars Rebels, so this is kind of my first time seeing Darth Vader in this context. But I really did like the kind of view of Darth Vader as the monster and encountering people who cannot fight him. Because when we see him in the other movies, even when it's, you know, Luke in, like, Empire, Luke can't beat him, but he can hold his own. He's not just going to get killed immediately. We're not seeing him from that perspective here, and I like bringing him back and having him be terrifying. And I think those two scenes are good, and it provides easily the best shot in this movie, which is... that the black screen, you hear the breathing, and then the lightsaber ignites, and the scene is lit by the red lightsaber.
Yeah.
That's just a brilliant image.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
I mean, it is very similar to how he's introduced, or not how he's introduced, but when it is big scenes in the season 2 premiere of Rebels. So,
okay.
Like, it is something where, like, I think that scene had, like, it's a fucking awesome scene where he kills the Rebels. Like, I'm not going to, like, take anything away from it like that. But it definitely had less of an impact on me because I think he is used better in Rebels because he... is used as a character in Rebels and not just as, like, hey, it's Darth Vader, which is kind of like what it felt like in this movie.
Well, you know, what it felt like in this movie is that Darth Vader would obviously exist in this scenario.
Yeah.
They probably would deploy him to try to stop that. And so if you need a bad guy in that moment, makes sense for it to be him. I agree there's not an extra level of thematic thing going on there, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I like both of those scenes, and I think, you know, I think the other scene, the dialogue-based scene, works well enough in trying to convey the ambition of the Ben Mendelsohn character and how he's clearly running up against a brick wall with that, and setting up his desperation for those final scenes. So, you know, I think he's used well enough in that way. It does make me interested to see Rebels, because clearly, you know, this and season two of Rebels would have been made at the same time.
Yeah, there are like a couple of like little references to Rebels in this.
Okay, that's nice. But I just think that that's an interesting thing that is kind of in the Star Wars ether right now.
Yeah, that we can have Darth Vader back and like have it be proper Darth Vader, but you can do it because it is like really fun to see Darth Vader from that other perspective of like just having him be the top dog of the Empire and that like he is completely unstoppable. I mean, that's the thing of like what's really fun about the season two premiere of Star Wars Rebels, which is the first time he had like a significant presence on the show, is that you have been following Kanan, who's this sort of Jedi Padawan during the Clone Wars, whose master was killed during the Clone Wars, so his training is incomplete. So he's like, he's the most powerful guy in the room because he's the closest to being a proper Jedi, but he doesn't really know what he's doing. And there's something amazing about that moment where Darth Vader comes in and then Kanan realizes, like, we can't do anything to him because that's not some dude who's, like, kind of a Force-sensitive and someone handed him a lightsaber. He's a Dark Lord of the Sith. Like, we just run away. That's what we do when we see this guy is we fucking turn and run because he will kill all of us.
Yeah.
So it is really like, I put this tweet out, but I'll just say it here. Like, if you liked Darth Vader in this movie, you need to watch the season two at least. I mean, you should watch season one of Star Wars Rebels also because it's really good. But like the season two premiere and season two finale of Star Wars Rebels has some amazing Darth Vader shit in it.
Nice. It's nice that James Earl Jones is still willing to do this.
Yeah.
I was a little distracted. I don't know if he can fully do the voice anymore.
Yeah, it was something where I think he does actually a way better job in Star Wars Rebels. Like, he sounds a lot better in that. Like, his dialogue scene here felt like sounded a little weird in a way that, like... Like, obviously he sounds different, a little different regardless because he's a much older man. But, like, it didn't sound quite right. I agree.
Yeah. Not that it distracted necessarily. No, yeah. It's, you know, it's still... It felt like Darth Vader-y. They didn't do anything bad to the character.
Yeah, yeah.
Or anything like that. So, yeah. And I actually also really liked in that scene where they're coming in and you have him, like, in the bath pod, like, just as, like, a husk.
Yeah.
Before he actually gets in the suit. That was another, like, little... I liked that. As kind of a better or a bigger version of what you got in that little hint of it in Empire Strikes Back where they could show a little more. And it felt like... Because this is, you know, chronologically, this is the movie that happens between 3 and 4.
Yeah.
So, like, as a middle point, that felt like a good thing to see. Yeah. Although, I say between 3 and 4...
Yeah, it runs up in a way that, like, is a little... Almost sort of, like, doesn't make 100% sense. It runs up right to the beginning of Episode 4.
Yeah.
Where it's, like... It recontextualizes that line where Leia's like, we're on a diplomatic mission to Alderaan. And Darth is... Bitch, I just saw your ship launch, like, over this massive battle we just had. Like, I was there. I killed, like, 15 people, like, 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
Don't give me this bullshit.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe, like, that happened weeks later, and for some reason we don't see that. I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know how else you would kind of do that, but it works.
Sure.
Yeah. So, getting back to the movie itself. Well, I mean, we've been talking about the bigger picture. You know, so you have that last scene. I don't know how much we'll go into it. I think there's a lot of great production value there. I think the different stages of the battle and how they are willing to let these characters die, I think, is interesting. I think my favorite shot was maybe the Darth Vader thing. My other one, in terms of actual, like, thematic impact, I did love the shot of Donnie Yen and the payoff of that line, I am the Force is with me, where he gets up, he has the cane, and the way they frame that of him walking through this really wide frame and gauntlet, it's a beautiful shot. I think it's a powerful shot. It works very well for me. And there's a lot of other very powerful images, like the Death Star rising over the clouds and coming in at the last minute. And just when you think that maybe there's some hope for these people to get out of this, the Death Star comes up and it's literally, there's nothing left. And they have to transmit that out. And, you know, some of the stuff, I think, with Jin and the Diego Luna character at the end, you know, I think there's a lot of good stuff there. And I think I almost wish the movie ended on the specific image of that, like, nuclear cloud coming up over the water and the two of them hug and it, like, fades to white. I actually thought that was going to be where they were going to cut to credits. And I might, if I were making this movie, re-edit it so that, like, after they transmit the plans, then maybe you have the scene where Darth Vader is on the ship and Leia gets the plans and zooms off, and then I would come back and end with them on the planet, realizing there's nowhere to go, and they kind of embrace, because I think, you know, it's a really potent image, however well they've built those characters or
not. Yeah, and it's one of the things I don't like about how they end the movie the way they do, is that it does feel like... And it's stuff that, like, that pops up a lot in this movie. Like, it feels like they're a bit too, like, winky-winky with, like, it's a prequel. Like, Star Wars happens right after this movie. And it's something where it's like, yes, it does, but that's that movie. Like, let's... Yeah. Even if I don't think you did well by your characters for most of this movie, like, at least finish with them. And, like, that, like...
Because that would be a great ending, I think.
Yeah, no. Like, it's a fantastic image. It's one of the best parts of the movie is that, how they end it.
And I really like some of the... You know, and again, I think... Felicity Jones is doing the acting that this character in her ideal form needs, which is this character who, you know, is so determined at that last point to make her family's broken legacy mean something.
Yeah.
And have her meaningless life mean something. And I think it is a testament to how good she does and how potent some of that imagery is, that even how hard I think they whiff some of the character stuff early on, there, I do think there's impact to some of those moments of performance and imagery in the end, even if I think it is naturally diluted at least a little by what happened early on. And to some people, probably a lot. So, you know.
Yeah. So, yeah, I want to go into, like, some of my problems with the action climax of this movie, because, like I said earlier, like, there are parts of it that I like in theory that, like, I think, like, you know, a lot of it is, like, really beautifully staged and choreographed and stuff like that, but, like, while I was actually watching it, I was mostly kind of bored and kind of waiting for it to be over. I think there, like, and a big, probably the biggest part of it is that, like, the characters were not well-established and developed at all, so, like, I did not really care when anyone died. Like I cared in a, like, oh, no, but not in a, like, I didn't really feel it. I didn't have, like, an emotional kick or something, which is, if you're doing a movie where all your main characters die, like, that should have a strong emotional kick to it, and it didn't have that at all to me. And I think I think it's not just that the characters are not well-established. I think there are some issues in how they stage the action climax that are a bit sloppy, and that it has... To me, what is the most egregious example of stuff happening totally by accident is the whole thing where they go to this planet on their own as Rogue One to do this thing, and while they're doing it, the fucking, not Admiral Ackbar, which is the one weird spot where they used restraint of not using an already established character where it's like, it might as well have been Admiral Ackbar. I don't know why they didn't.
He's in Force Awakens. Maybe that's the reason
why.
Yeah,
sure, maybe why. It just felt weird of like, you had a fucking cameo of the dude that like, the dude and his alien buddy that pester Luke and A New Hope in the fucking cantina. Like, there was a cameo of those two guys.
In the city that gets destroyed, that made very little sense.
Yeah, exactly. Like, those motherfuckers hauled ass to Tatooine, man.
Yeah.
Like, really, if you think about the timeline. But, like, whatever. Like, I didn't care that much about that reference. It was a bit weird. But, like, if you're gonna fucking reference those characters, Admiral Ackbar has a reason to fucking be there. Like, he's in Rebels. We know that he's, like, a part of this organization already. But regardless, that's beside the point. So, not Admiral Ackbar then shows up and brings, like, a huge amount of the Rebel fleet to fight. But, like, all that does is because their whole plan was we're going to infiltrate this base to get the plans and, like, either get the plans out or transmit them. But, like, the one thing that will stop us from transmitting them, and they say this before they land, is this shield door. That's why we have to make sure that our, like, passcode thing works so that we can get through the shield door. And it's like, great, okay, that makes sense. But then when not Admiral Ackbar jumps into the system with his whole fucking fleet, that means that the Empire closes the shield door, which means that they need to then get the shield door open. So it's like the whole, like, huge half of the entire action climax is this weird, stupid closed loop that actually the thing it most reminded me of is the end of Batman v Superman, where Lois Lane grabs the spear and throws it in the water and, like, 10 minutes later has to go get the spear out of the water and almost drowns. Like, it's the same thing where it's like, this is a cool action sequence in the abstract, but, like, the plotting of it is so insanely sloppy that, like, they're just cleaning up their own mess. They don't accomplish anything significant. Like, all those people die for no fucking good reason, because if they had never shown up, it would have been fucking fine. And it's, like, so weird to me that, like, that's how you would stage that.
Boy, I had not thought of that. I didn't notice it in the moment. But, yeah, I mean, I see... It's a lot of stuff where, yes, the script clearly needed a second pass. Because, again, I think there's a good... justification, narratively, thematically, all that, to have the Rebel fleet wind up
show
there.
Show up to, like, support them. Right. Sure, yeah.
But you're right that there it needed to not be a self-defeating thing.
Yeah.
Because that's just a, you clean up a line in the script and you're good.
Yeah, it's just a weird thing that they do structurally. Then the other thing that made it so that, like, all the spaceship, well, like, the space fight, I thought looked cool and was well-staged on its own, I had no emotional connection to it at all because there's no character involved with the space fight at all. Which is like, you have a cast of like 6-7 main characters, and one of those main characters, his whole role of the fucking flight is that he's literally a pilot, and somehow you did not find a way to have him be in the space fight. Because it's like, to me, I would equate it to like at the end of Two Towers or something, where you have all this shit at Helm's Deep, but then you keep on cutting to Isengard, but in this version of Two Towers, Merry and Pippin are not with Treebeard at Isengard, sure. And you just keep on cutting there, and it's like, well, I get that this is important in the scope of, like, the war, like, I have no emotional connection to what is happening in this phase of the battle, because there is no character I know. It's all just, like, red leader, gold leader, blue leader, like...
In a more direct Star Wars comparison, it would be like if there was no Poe Dameron in Force Awakens.
Sure, or if Lando was not in the fight at the end of Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, you need some character there to anchor it so that we have something to go back to. And it's something where that last battle scene has so many moving pieces of, like, at some point, there's like four different groups that is constantly cutting between, and one of those groups has no named character in it at all. Like, the closest they have is not Admiral Akbar. That's like...
Maybe it just should have been Admiral Akbar.
Yeah, that, like, it would have... There'd be at least some assumed empathy on part of the audience that knows who Akbar is. But it's like, it's such a weird missight or something of, like, it feels like there's supposed to be a character there, but there isn't. So it's just, like, you cutting to all these random people that you don't know. And I found, like, that was one of the things that made it really boring, was I was just kept on, like, cut back to fucking Donnie Yen. Like, cut back to female lead. Like, cut back to someone. Like, cut back to a character I recognize at least a little bit, and, like, or at least the battle around them to give me some sort of emotional anchor point. As little of an emotional anchor point as any of these characters already served to me, like, at least there is one. Like, there wasn't one in the space battle, and that's one of the issues I had with it.
Okay. I understand that. I mean... Yeah, I think the overall orchestration of it is what was working for me, but sure. I do understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird issue. This movie needed more time to bake, is my...
Definitely, yeah.
You know, it does not feel like... It felt like maybe it... not like anything visually in the movie feels rushed, again, for putting aside Tarkin for a minute.
Right.
You know, everything else, I think, as a production, it feels fine, but I agree, you know, it feels like the script was kind of written in a week and then we went and shot the movie, and I don't, you know, maybe that's the problem with making movies on a yearly basis. I don't know.
Who knows? Like, it is a weird thing because, like, it is, like, undeniably, like, the visual quality of the movie is so high and there are so many great images and sequences, but, like, the fundamental storytelling of the movie to me is, like, insanely poor, and, okay. Like, I just couldn't get past that part.
Yeah. I wouldn't say insanely, but I agree with a lot of those criticisms, so... You know, but the thing is, I do like the idea of doing these Star Wars movies that are not part of the main forward-moving story.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, that's maybe one of the reasons why I feel as negative on this movie as I do, is that I was really excited for it because I thought the trailers were so good, and I thought, like, Gareth Edwards had so much potential, because, like, he's such a great director based on what he did with Godzilla, and, like, this trailer's great, and, like, the cast is great, Donnie Yen is great, like... Zhang Wen is great. That's another part of, like, he's the other, like, Donnie Yen's character's buddy. And if, for people listening to this, if you really like those two characters in this movie, you should watch this movie that came out a couple of years ago called The Lost Bladesman that's loosely based on sections of Romance of the Three Kingdoms, where Donnie Yen plays Guan Yu and Zhang Wen plays Cao Cao. It is a fantastic movie, and they are fantastic in it.
So awesome. That's
a little shout out to that film. But...
And then Donnie Yen is famous for the Ip Man trilogy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, all those are on Netflix. Like, he's just, like, one of the best Hong Kong, like, kung fu stars right now. And it's, like, at least, if nothing else, the one thing that this movie does give us is that Donnie Yen is a prominent character in this movie. Like, he's, like, a prominent character in the trailers. He has, like, everyone who's talking about it loves him in this movie. And this movie is making a shit ton of money. So if we get nothing else from this movie, I hope that means that like Donnie Yen has now like a market over here that he can do stuff in the West, because I think like there's a lot of potential for him here.
I mean, I really hope they keep up this tradition of each Star Wars movie having a different famous martial artist, because Force Awakens had this too. It had to be changed for a very good post-production reason, which is the scene they were shooting is where Harrison Ford broke his leg. So right, that scene really did not... They had to change the scene in the finished movie. But in the scene where they're on the ship with the Rathtars in Force Awakens, the guys who come for Harrison Ford are the main actors from The Raid, which is Gareth Evans, a different actor.
I have since then, I have seen The Raid and The Raid 2, so now I need to rewatch at least that part of The Force Awakens to see them.
Those are great movies, right?
Yeah, no, those are fucking awesome.
Those are fucking awesome. So I hope they do more with that and like maybe even build up those roles a little more until we get a spinoff that is just a full-on Hong Kong action movie in space.
Because that is, like, if you go back to the prequels, like, that's one of the things that makes the lightsaber battles in those movies as good as they are, is that they are not, like, samurai movie action scenes. They are Hong Kong kung fu action scenes and sort of their the way they're shot and stuff. And that's actually one, like, other, like, it's not a big deal, but it felt like, as someone who is a big fan of Donnie Yen and his movies, and for people who know, like, the style of Hong Kong action movies, is there's a big tradition of the main actor of, like, your Bruce Lee, Jackie Chan, Jet Li, Donnie Yen, like, there's Sammo Hung, there's a bunch of them. They're the main actor, they're also, like, the choreographer and the director, often, like, almost always the action director, and oftentimes also the full-on director and editor for their movies. So, like, there's they're basically auteur action movies in a way. And so, like, Donnie Yen knows how to fucking shoot an action, choreograph an action scene, and it was like, I kind of wish, that, because you could so tell that he did not do his action scene where he fights the stormtroopers, because it is shot in the most, like, cliche, like, oh, spinning pan shot, that, like, that is that whole scene, is it's just a spinning pan around him while he hits a bunch of stormtroopers with a stick, and it's like... Fucking give, just let Donnie Yen handle that one scene, and it would have been like 100 times better. Like, it's fine in the movie, but it's not exceptional in the way that he could have done it, I'm sure.
I'm gonna expect as much as I'm gonna expect out of a Hollywood movie at this point. Yeah. So
it's just, you know, it's again, like, I'm a big fan of his films, and like, just like his acting, but like what else he brings to it. And
yeah,
like,
no, I get it.
It would have just been, it would have been fucking awesome.
Sure. Anything else to say about this movie? I mean, it is, as I was saying, it's our first of these Star Wars spin-offs. I hope they improve. This one, I think, had a lot of good things about it and a lot of messy things about it.
It's frustrating because this is the one that, like, we know about they're making that... I guess we only know for sure the Han Solo one. Have they talked about specifically any of the others yet?
Well, for a long time, it was kind of an open secret that the third one was going to be a Boba Fett movie.
Right, yeah.
But it really sounds like that's been canned. Okay. Because that was going to be directed by Josh Trank, who flamed out spectacularly Fantastic Four and will probably never work in Hollywood again. And they canceled that, so I don't know if they even have anything on the calendar for it. And it sounds like maybe they took some of that Boba Fett material and will put it in the Han Solo movie, which I think sounds like a better idea, frankly.
Sure, yeah.
So no, we really don't know. The only other thing we know about is the Han Solo, and then 8 and 9.
Yeah, because I was actually kind of into the direction that it seemed like Rogue One was going. It was like, you know, even if this is like the most like. You know, I mean, I went home and I played the first level of Star Wars Dark Forces on my PC just to be like, yeah, like, we've done the Death Star plans thing before. But, like, even if with that, like, I thought the direction they were going based on the trailers, I was really excited for this one. And hopefully, you know, like you said, like, the casting and the directors and stuff for the Han Solo one are, like, those are all good people. But, like, still conceptually, I just can't get behind the idea of a young Han Solo movie.
No,
I'm so not interested in that idea at all. That's, like... I'm way more interested in them using these like spin-off movies to explore new territory. Even if like I will count Death Star plans as new territory because it was only covered in expanded universe stuff. But it's like Han Solo is not really new territory. That's a character we know. I want to see new characters and new places and stuff.
I agree, and I can understand the logic for the first two they're doing trying to ease people into it, because if they just went crazy with it and did like. Something way out there for their first spin-off one, that's a risk that I understand they're not willing to take. And I think easing people into it and getting used to having Star Wars movies that are not episodic numbers where there's a clear story that goes through them. Hopefully after the Han Solo one, I would love to see them open it up. I mean, honestly, one of the things I would love, if they get far enough with this, is let the animation team come in and do an animated movie or something like that.
That was what I was thinking for, like, half of this movie was, like, God, the Star Wars Rebels people would be doing this better. Partially because, like, there are references to Star Wars Rebels. It's set before Episode 4, which is simply, like, it just felt like, in the Darth Vader connection, it was like, oh, man, like, they're so good at this stuff. And, like, I'm happy that they're doing it. Like, I'm really excited for Star Wars Rebels Season 3 to wrap up so I can get into it. But, like, it would be awesome to see those guys, like, get to, like, put out something on the big screen for the first time since, like, the premiere of Clone Wars.
Yeah. Which I don't even know if we can count that as a movie because it was just the pilot.
Yeah, it was just the first three episodes of the show stitched together for sure.
Like, very clearly.
Yeah.
It's good. It's fine.
Yeah, I like it.
Unless you view it as a movie, in which case it's not a movie.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, so... But I mean, yeah, I mean, it's the first non-Star Wars Star Wars movie in a weird way. And, you know, there's things like, this is the first one without John Williams. And I think Michael Giacchino did a good job, kind of as well as you can under the circumstances.
Yeah, it sounded like a Star Wars video game soundtrack to me.
But not as good in some ways. Like, no. I will say this. Like, I think Michael Giacchino is an incredibly talented guy. I think there's a lot of the score here that I like, where I think he's specifically trying to do the style of scoring John Williams did in A New Hope. And it's a very hard thing to do, and I think sometimes he pulls it off very well. But there are other moments, and I had a long talk with my brother about this, because he's a composer, and, like, the non-Star Wars Star Wars theme this movie uses is really bad, because it's like trying to... It starts doing the fanfare, but then it goes somewhere else, and it's like, nope, doesn't work.
And it felt like out of tone for the movie. Like, I thought that was a weird piece.
That's the biggest thing, as I was going to say, is overall, I think it's a good score, but I think it's for the wrong movie. Like, this movie needed, to me, a considerably darker score.
Yeah.
Like, it was originally going to be scored by Alexander Desplat, and I actually think that would have been really smart, and also, hopefully, he would have relied even less, I think, on the Williams stuff, because other than the Imperial March, I don't think you need any of that in here.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of where Giacchino would go, like, the main theme of this movie for Jin is, like, a version of the Han and Leia theme from Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
Like, it's clearly in that direction, and to me, it's at tonal odds. It's just, again, it's not something that, like, I would mark the movie down for. It's just where, like, and again, no one's ever had to do that in a Star Wars movie, so I get that it's a really tough thing to figure out how to do, but I don't know. Like, to me, I've said this before, Michael Giacchino seems like the right composer for the Han Solo movie, not necessarily for this. So I'm curious to see what they do going forward. Also because John Williams isn't going to be around forever, and if they keep making main-numbered episodes,
hey,
someone's going to...
You can just have CGI John Williams. It's fine. Luckily, I'm sure that would work just as well.
Luckily, we can't replace him that way. But yeah, so I'm curious to see what they do with this in the future. I liked this well enough, but my final thought is my first thought, which is I totally understand the people who love it, and I totally understand the people who hate it. I'm just not either one of those.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. I think it is an okay movie, I guess. I can totally see people watching this movie not having as big of an issue with the issues in it. But, like, yeah, for me, it is something, like, the more I think about it, the more some of its flaws kind of stand out to me. Like, not... Like, and it feels like a movie that has a, like, really great visual style to it, but that's not all that a movie needs to be. Or that, specifically, that's not all that this movie needs to be. Like, it is not trying to tell a story that you can just coast on that, you know? It's a story that needs characters that you empathize with, and it needs a story that, like, you understand and can follow and get into, you know?
Yeah. So, anyway, that is Star Wars Rogue One, or Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, however we want to call it.
Star Wars, A Rogue One Story.
All right. So, Sean, we're probably not going to record next weekend because you'll be out of town, right?
No, we are definitely not recording next weekend because I'm out of town.
And that would be Christmas Day.
Yes.
So, we'll figure out when to record off camera.
Yes. There will be at least a week break, maybe a two-week break.
Yeah, we'll see. Maybe we can record sooner. Our next episode, we can commit to, I think, will be our top 10 games of the year.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, depending on when we record it, the next episode might also talk about the Doctor Who Christmas special.
Yeah.
But I think that'll be a separate thing. But anyway, we'll figure out.
I have been rewatching season 9 of Doctor Who.
Nice.
I just last night I watched Sleep No More, which is like the weak episode of that season. I think that episode stands up better when you can just accept it as being stupid. And it's an entertaining, stupid episode of Doctor Who. I kind of liked it more the second time.
Nice. But overall, season 9 still good?
Season 9 is fucking great. It's so good, man.
It's crazy. All right, so that'll be our next episode. And I want to, I'm going to try that. I think that should be our last episode of the year, is the top 10 games thing. And then we can start the new year with something else. So we'll figure it out. But that's it for us on Rogue One. Hopefully this isn't our last episode of the year. If it is, bye.
Yeah, I mean, I think... It's weird, but I feel like since we talked about Infinite Warfare and Rogue One, both things where, like, just everyone dies at the end, I feel like the only appropriate way to end this episode is for us to die, but I kind of don't want to.